From the Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, this is Film Grok. This week's film is The Godfather. My name is Serge Delpierre, and today we have...
Tim McMillan.
And also...
Duncan K. Fraser.
Hey guys, welcome.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Welcome. Cue point for this week is the end of the Paramount logo. The music will have already started, so just inch your way as the logo fades to black. Cue it there, and we'll give you a little bit of time while we will talk briefly about our first experiences seeing this film. So who goes first? Tim.
I will go first. I saw it on a theatrical reissue about over 15 years ago. It was my first time to see it. I've only seen it once, so forgive me, but I enjoyed it.
What?
I know. Can you believe this? An epic.
What?
The American.
Wait, are you an American?
I know.
No, you're thinking of Star Wars.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Star Wars, too.
Okay,
all right.
Yeah, so, but as far as the, you know, the reputation of this film, I've been pummeled my entire life with, you know, The Godfather. So when I saw the reissue coming out, I was like, oh, well, I have to see this in the theater. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again today after all this time, only because I don't think I digested enough of the story, screenplay, the tapestry that's being woven. I think I may have been unfocused or something, but overall, I just remember thinking that, well, these are people that get what they deserve, and I don't feel too sympathetic towards one over the other, that someone being taken advantage of and unjustly coming to an end they shouldn't. So maybe I'm being a little too hard on it, but I'll see if there's some sympathies in there I missed the first time.
I like that. That's good.
There's going to be a horse head in your bed tomorrow.
Right?
Oh, boy. Duncan?
Believe the first time I saw this film was when I was in high school. Definitely did not have the opportunity to see this in the theater, as I was not born yet, being 1972.
Well, it could have run again. In
could
the
have.
Theater,
well, I mean,
you could have gone to
you know
see
what
it.
Freaks me out is that the 90s were 15 years ago plus. That trips me out. I don't know. But
trips you out?
It does. Doesn't seem that long ago.
Trips us out. Trust
yeah,
me.
Yeah, right. How should I say this? I guess being in high school, I had a different kind of take on it. Also, I have a close family member who was friends with this son of a somewhat influential mob guy around the Chicago / Kalamazoo area. So I kind of have a different take on organized crime, not like I, you know, grew up hearing, you know, glamorous stories or anything like that, but I think I am kind of sympathetic to these people in that this isn't the kind of thing where, you know, it's not like a job. It's not like you go out and apply and, you know, get in the mob necessarily. Like you either grow up with it a part of your life or you don't. And, you know, this is of course a film, and yeah, maybe killing and blowing things up is a part of that life, being in that, but, you know, it's by and large about moving money, and it's all illegal, of course, but at the same time, you know, that's how those people live. That's all they know. It's not like they had a choice, or even if they wanted to get out that they could. So
that's what I want to examine.
That's what I
not have a choice.
Some do, some don't.
Actually, is a great film trope, because it is rather existential. So it's a thing to. I mean, it's been examined quite a few times in films. I don't know if necessarily in this one, because this isn't a film about getting out. This is about life in. You know?
Right.
I mean,
right.
About, as Coppola said before, this is about the American dream. In fact, you know, the first opening scene, mm-hmm. which we'll get to in just mm-hmm. a moment.
Well, and that's.
But
that's
I see it
important.
As everyone having a choice. I see that if you. It would involve removing yourself from your family to a good extent, but you have a choice.
Well, okay, and so we'll get into that actually, because it's right, because that's what happens with Al Pacino. In a way, he does have a choice, but the choice is kind of pointed interesting, because it brings up a point I have about this film. Remember that, okay, about the choice of it.
Okay.
Anyway, so have you seen it since, Dunk?
Yeah, I've seen it probably 3 or 4 times, lifetime.
Right.
So I think the last time I saw it was maybe like a good 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or some such.
I was born before 1972, but I was
shocked.
I was too young, and as anyone who's listened to Film Grok before, I've said I grew up in Quebec, and where we had the film classification system of for all 14 and over and 18 and over, and I wasn't, and I think this was 14 and over, so I wasn't able to actually see this. So I only knew it by reputation. I actually saw this in college in a film studies class where we were studying film noir and modern noir. So this is one of the modern films we saw. So that was the first time. I was like, well, this is really cool. And I saw it a few times on video. Saw it 15 years ago when it came out. Saw it in Washington, D.C. at KB Cinema. It was a nice big theater that I saw Empire Strikes Back in back in 1980. It was awesome. And then when I saw it, when I saw The Godfather, the theater didn't smell all too good anymore.
Sour popcorn and moldy upholstery.
Oh, just even worse.
Asbestos.
It's just like, oh, man.
What kinds of films were they showing there?
They had been showing first runs, but this was, you know, Godfather was a special release when they released it. So I have no idea if it's still around. If anyone who's from Washington knows that, they can.
For real cinephiles,
I guess I should check it out next time I'm back.
For real cinephiles, they should have the car air freshener that replicates the smell you're talking about.
They really should.
No.
They should.
And anyway, I've seen it since, I've seen it on video a few times, but of course I see it on AMC whenever I happen to be at my parents' house and we have AMC on, of course, and Godfather's always running, and me and my mom will sit down and watch it. We'll watch one, and we'll watch two, and we'll even watch three. So,
And your mom likes them?
Oh, yeah, she loves them. Oh, yeah, Godfather. Yeah, my mom has taste.
Cool. I wonder if it's a chick flick, though. I mean, not that...
My mom likes
action.
Did you
just call Godfather a chick flick?
My mom likes action movies, okay? Okay.
No, I just mean as far as women compared to men in the responding to this film, I wonder if there's a difference, you know, the way they respond.
It would be interesting to find out.
Right, especially because they do focus on more than one female character in the film. And, you know, most people watch movies and they automatically gravitate toward relating to what's going on through.
But the female characters in this particular one aren't central.
No, right. But I'm just saying...
They orbit.
They totally orbit.
You know, whatever character a person latches onto in any given film is going to be closest to what they recognize or what they sympathize with or what they can relate to. So it would make sense that, you know, women would gravitate toward the same gender when they're trying to, like, experience the film, and that would give them a different experience of the film, necessarily.
Possibly.
Yeah, I don't want to generalize. I don't want to generalize, but I wonder if... there's a difference in how men respond to this film compared to women, that this is more of a known as a guy's film overall, or if it's equal.
There is a lot of shooting.
Yeah.
To me, it's a lot of testosterone stuff going on.
Then I'd say, hey, if anyone out there wants to let us know, write us at hey@filmgrok.com.
Well, I like that.
Like that little plug.
Does the hey have an exclamation point?
No, actually, it's just hey@filmgrok.com. Okay. You can go on the
just
website
checking.
And see. Actually, if you go to where it says hey, and it says hey, write us at hey.
Neat.
So please, someone, write us. We want to hear. Anyway, on that note, let's get going. So I will count down in just a moment. There's the remote. Okay, so 3, 2, 1, play.
We go back to 1972.
And the great music. Now, Godfather is actually based on a pulp novel by Mario Puzo, which was, I call it pulp, I don't know, it was basically considered a pulp novel back then, and it was a bestseller, and it was doing great business, and then, of course, the studios decided to make a movie, and there's the whole story. You can listen to the commentary to find out all about the ins and outs of that. But in reading the book, this is actually in the book, but this is like the second or third scene. And so, basically, Coppola moved this right up. But this basically states the thesis of the whole thing, which is, I believe in America. This is the American dream. And, of course, we have Gordon Willis's wonderful cinematography.
Which was daring for its time because of the amount of shadows and black that were used in the picture. Not this high-key lighting where you see the entire set. He was very, the mood of it all, a lot of black. Mm-hmm. And the guy's lit directly from above, making dark circles under his eyes, which mainstream Hollywood was aghast at when they saw the rushes for this movie of Gordon Willis's lighting. What are you doing lighting people like this? We can't see the set. They got bags under their eyes. What... So he came from a whole different viewpoint for this movie.
We can't see the set.
We can't see... exactly. Look at this. The guy's pops like anything, but I don't see the set.
But I don't
want to
see the set. Here, look. We see his face, and that's the most important thing. And what's great, okay, you know how much I hate zoom-ins and zoom-outs, but this is an excellent use.
It's very slow. It's a very nice slow zoom.
Is this a zoom? This is a zoom.
Yeah, because everything's moving at the same...
Yeah, this is awesome. Rate. And then what we do is we get the over-the-shoulder of with the hand. Brilliant. Brilliant. And then we have another character introduced, great mise-en-scène, mm-hmm. just with the hand adding mm-hmm. the drink.
Stylistically, I find this interesting because, you know, the impression I get with the hand and the back of the head and the shadow and the desk is total James Bond villain.
Yeah, we need a kitty cat.
That would sort of been a thing.
We need a kitty cat
and
a lap.
We're all right.
And he's the white cat, too,
but
yeah.
This is actually, in the context of the film, the hero of the film, or at least the centerpiece of the film that we're about to see.
Right.
I find that an interesting stylistic choice.
Well, I mean, you know, in the same respect, I mean, this is... You were talking about sympathetic or unsympathetic characters. This was definitely came in 72 during Vietnam, and this is definitely, I'd say, an anti-hero.
Right, right.
I mean, this is, in a way, this is the apotheosis of the anti-hero.
Hmm. He's, you're speaking, I mean, of Brando's character?
Yeah, he's a criminal, essentially a criminal kingpin.
Right.
That is what he is. So, from what we learn of society, I mean, he should be the bad guy, but he's the good guy in this. It's essentially his and his family's story.
And that's where I had my troubles in associating my sympathies towards anyone.
And that's where the brilliance of this film is that it plays with you. This was a great cut to reveal him.
Yeah.
It plays with how you normally watch film or relate to film, to get you slowly but surely to perhaps sympathize mm-hmm. with the bad guy and with mm-hmm. one of the bad guys.
Oh, we do have a cat.
And they do bad things.
There you go, see?
But it's not white, but it's a cat.
No, but...
There is a story behind the cat you can hear on the commentary with Coppola.
Now, do we know how much Brando went off script? I mean, did he just have his good old improv times on this movie?
I don't know. They didn't talk about it in the commentary, but it seems like he stayed pretty much on. I mean, he was a big jokester, and he would definitely try and throw you and keep everything alive. But I mean,
interesting.
But for example, the cat, I'll just relay the story, is Coppola found the cat on the studio. He gave it to Marlon, and he just did it, literally, and just went with it.
Well, the cat didn't mind being on camera.
No. He's like, please stay with me. And actually, the interesting thing is there's kind of a rule in terms of at least a theater. You never want to put an animal on stage because the animal will always upstage an actor.
Full focus.
They will, mm-hmm. because they'll be realer. They will totally believe in the circumstance in the moment. And here you've got Brando essentially acting away with the cat's not distracting from him at all. Brando's just so in the moment.
So
he captures it.
When was Last Tango in Paris? To this,
I think a year or two after.
After this,
yes, after.
Okay.
This essentially revitalized his career.
Right,
his career had been out for, I don't know, 5-6 years.
As far as the arc, it's good to know he wasn't the hottest thing going. Right.
He was totally not the hottest.
Well, you know, he almost. I mean, he basically made his own audition. Like he practically crashed the thing. Like he wasn't even being asked, and he actually called up and begged. Okay, I can't remember if it was Scorsese or if it was the casting director, but
Scorsese
and just came in and was
Scorsese?
Like
Scorsese.
Huh?
Coppola.
Yeah, sorry, I get names mixed up. I'm bad with names. Anyway, came in, and it was either Coppola or the casting director, and he just said, I can do this part, and they were thinking of him from his previous films, and they didn't think so.
Mm.
But he stuffed the cotton balls in his cheeks
right.
and just started doing some of the lines, and they were like, oh, sold. Okay, mm. he's it.
Because I know between this and Last Tango in Paris, that's what put him back on the map.
Right. Actually, mm-hmm. I mean, Coppola tells a bit of a different story on the commentary, but it's interesting to listen to the commentaries and also what you read, how there's different right. stories about how different things actually happen.
Right.
Well, I mean, one thing is that comes out from reading and everything, the making of this film was definitely not easy at all.
Mm-hmm.
Godfather 2 was much smoother because they had confidence, but essentially they put Coppola in there apparently because he was a young director. You know, and could see what he could do, and actually, in the process of this, he won the Oscar for Patton, and that kind of lightened the mood a little.
Oh, I see. So it was a high-risk project.
Oh, it was high-risk, but more of a control thing, too. Also, Robert Evans was the producer on this.
Are you kidding? You know...
This is a Robert Evans production.
That guy really has a body of work, as far as what he greenlit and what he was associated with. I thought he was someone being famous for just being famous.
Oh, no, no.
A lot of his reputation.
He did this. He did, was Chinatown.
Yeah. In the early 70s, mid 70s, lots of great films. I didn't know that.
Now we're introduced to all the characters we're going to need to know. We see James Caan.
When he still had hair.
He was young. We see, you know, the Godfather's wife, the mother. We see Talia Shire. We get a flavor for the world.
Oh, yeah, totally. It trips me out seeing this because the bridesmaids' outfits and everything look a lot like my parents' wedding. I mean, it's obviously a style of the 70s, but it's like, wait a minute, that kind of resembles my parents. My parents, they got married in 74.
And now
so
here we
this
get
would have been really close.
Okay, that's about
okay,
right.
Yeah, yeah. And now we get the flavor. We have the, you know, of course, the FBI taking down license plates.
Right. So always being watched.
So, and without being told, I mean, we're being shown. And this is great craftsmanship.
That's cinema.
But
yeah.
Now, do it's they good. Reveal later that those are FBI guys? Because, or are they about to? Because I wouldn't know.
No, I think James Caan comes out and starts. There's Abe Vigoda. This actually started Abe Vigoda's career.
Hmm.
Yeah, he apparently was in a catacall. And he got the gig.
Was there an outcry?
I was going to say. Now this is really interesting. We're about 8 minutes in. And we've just seen like the main villain. That was a main villain, Barzini.
Oh.
I hope everyone's seen this film before they listen to this. But here, already the whole thing is to introduce your villain, you know, up front, essentially, and in a way, this is like the real opening of the film with the wedding, and we're Absolutely. Seeing all of our characters. We're seeing. Richard Castellano. Oh my God!
Was there an outcry at the time of this film's release?
Oh wow!
Or
I never
thereafter,
saw that. I never saw that.
Oh, where that's, he gives that, her
that's,
a little.
Actually, that's the girl that he's going
yeah,
to shtup
later.
In just a few
yeah.
minutes. Oh wow!
Yeah, I didn't remember that
and that's
part
his wife, and she's like, "I just caught you, you." You were saying, I'm sorry?
Was there an outcry at the time of this film's release or thereafter from the Italian community at all? Does anyone, how things are being portrayed?
I don't know.
Did it push any buttons?
Likely it did, but I don't remember reading anything.
On top of which, this isn't exactly this is not a villainizing movie. This is kind of, like you said, it's a somewhat documentary style.
Even though
it shows the bad things that they do.
But in a way, it's from their point of view.
Exactly. Now, the only thing I can see them being really upset about is that it brought it to light at all, like the existence of this.
But there was also the novel. The novel had come out. I mean, of course, here we have the whole thing where we don't want you to take pictures. he takes it, destroys the film. It's like, that's it. So, yeah, no pictures. Which, of course, they're wedding pictures. And this is Robert... Now, Robert Duvall, I think, had worked with... Oh, there's the guy who plays Luke.
That was 10 years after To Kill a Mockingbird for Duvall.
And he'd done, I think, The Rain People with Coppola. Okay, so this is where Jimmy Caan comes out, and he's like, get out of here.
No.
This is where they tell him, see, flashes the badge. So what do you do in that case? You spit at him. It's like, great.
Right.
And he gives him the finger. Awesome. Yes. I like how Polly just sticks his hand in the jacket every time.
Right. At the ready.
There's all these things that are just really, just all these subtleties, and it's just everything is note perfect. It appears to be note perfect. I think this is Vito Scotti.
Oh, really?
Who was big in Disney films.
I think you're right.
I think it's his only appearance in the film.
Yeah, Vito Scotti was always in every fluff comedy
came
out.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
You're looking at us like we're crazy. Yeah, Vito Scotti, big T.
I believe you.
Character actor.
Oh, yeah, character actor.
Um, It's an interesting point that he Robert Duvall's character made is like, no, you know, it's a Sicilian tradition. You can't refuse any request on your daughter's wedding day or whatever. Well, I can totally see, like, especially somebody like The Godfather being just bombarded. Like,
yeah, I would
spend
hide
the whole
myself
day, like, well, just hearing things from people, you know.
But that's, and now we're introduced to Al Pacino with Kay, Diane Keaton. Right. Now the interesting point about this that you had brought up is that, I've always kind of been mystified, because really this is a story of the Godfather, you know, Don Corleone, but also about Michael, about how Michael becomes the Godfather, really,
right.
I mean, everything
right.
that happens around it. And I've always been curious about the transition of Michael, because Michael's like, no, that's part of the family that I don't really, you know, participate in. That's not my life. But then the transition happens after what happens to his father. And every time I watch it, I've never quite gotten the moment where he said, I will actually give into this life. Because before, I kind of...
Where's the point where it takes him over?
Where it takes him over, where he says, yes, this is okay.
He caves.
Because before, he's like, no, this is not for me. You know, he's the war hero and everything. This is awesome, how he's rehearsing this. And the whole thing with Kay is that she, you know, she essentially fell in love with the Michael who was not involved with this kind of stuff, who was outside of it, who was in the military and all that kind of thing. And he comes back to her and says, please, I need you. And then for love, she gets in, you know.
I remember spending a good deal of the film saying, get out, to Diane Keaton. Time to go. Bye-bye. Leave. Bye. Go. And she never did. And I thought, okay, then. There you go. You get what you get.
Right.
Which
of course,
is so easy to do when you're sitting in an audience, looking at a screen, as compared to what happens in people's lives.
Right.
It's easier said than done. I understand that.
Right, because, I mean, if in the way you look at it, I mean, she fell in love with Michael when he was like this.
Right.
Well, and two, you know, from what I understand, you even just if you are just doing a business, let's say you just have your own business, and or big company, small company, whatever, sometimes you don't even realize that the deal that you're getting from your wholesaler is actually connected to some kind of organized crime, or that, you know, the reason you can do this kind of business without being bothered is because of that. And, you know, some people never know. Some people find out because they try to change up something or whatever, but just some people just don't know.
I think, you know, a topic would be corruption, corruption and compromise, that it doesn't have to be over-the-top mob-related, but corruption enters in all different forms.
Oh, sure.
And people that either face it and change accordingly if they don't want to be involved, or become consumed by it, mm-hmm. you know, and not even aware.
Right.
And the
so
whole
this is a form of corruption in its way,
and it's a
people's
slow,
reactions
and,
to it.
And it's a slow seduction. That's the whole thing. It's a slow how you get into
right.
it. Now, just here, I mean, I love this whole thing with Luca Brasi, and this is where we're introduced to him, you know, obviously, because Luca Brasi is his main enforcer. Which will then, of course, come into play once the whole beginning. I guess you could say this is the first act, where we're just everything, all the little threads are laid out, and all the relationships are established.
Right.
And then we start seeing what's happening. The first thing that really happens is with Luca Brasi. Well, actually, the second thing. And there we go. Oh, this is funny.
Hmm.
What's she talking about? I have no idea what she's talking about.
Baking bread.
Zucchini.
She's talking about bread
increasing?
Yeah, because
like you put yeast into the dough and then it rises.
Oh, and then it rises bigger, and it gets right. bigger and bigger and bigger. Gotcha. Okay. I thought she was talking about something else, but I don't know.
No, I can't imagine what.
You see, that's show, don't tell. We
it
didn't
could
even
have been pickles because pickles get smaller when you pickle them because it's a cucumber. And then
I've never pickled cucumbers.
I mean, I haven't either, but I know what.
That's what you know?
What happens to them.
Apparently, she was a singer. That was her background.
Interesting.
That's actually a really nice microphone.
It's a radio mic.
Oh, yeah. Now, see, this is a way to have a wedding, a big, big festive wedding.
Yeah, but it's followed by how many funerals?
Okay, the wedding has nothing to do with everything else, but okay. It's a great wedding. It's a good time. You've got the band, you've got everyone singing, you've got a dance floor.
Seems like everyone in this movie either goes to the wedding or the funeral.
Is this Now, I don't know
it's
enough
a great
about
wedding.
Italian
I like it.
Culture.
Yes.
But is this, like, are they ad-libbing, like, songs right here?
No, I think they're actually, like they're singing songs that they know.
Oh, are they? Well, it's all in the same.
Oh, there's Vito Scotti again. There we go.
I wish I, right then, I wish I spoke Italian so I knew what was going on.
What are they doing?
They're baking bread.
He wants to show her his postcard collection.
And quite a postcard collection he has. And now we're introduced to, like they've got judges in the pocket. I mean, just you know the influence. And now we get, that's Al Martini. Who was more of a singer and not that much of an actor when he did this. I mean,
is he playing himself in this, or is he?
Oh no, he plays. What's his name?
Frank Sinatra.
Johnny something.
Oh,
yeah.
But he's the Frank Sinatra type.
Frank Sinatra type.
And his whole career is supplied by the mob, correct?
No, but they're going to help him in this particular instance where he really wants the film, and that's where the whole next part happens. And actually, he shows up in Godfather 3.
Yeah.
Oh, he does?
Yes, he does. And, yeah, he does.
Just noticed another design thing.
What?
The wedding dress.
That's Johnny Fontaine. That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
The wedding dress, when she was dancing earlier, it looked like she had a second veil that was almost like a bib kind of thing.
Oh.
And now she doesn't have that.
Mm. Ooh, that's a velvet.
So you're saying there's a continuity error?
I don't know if it's that or if it's like that was part of some tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many wedding traditions in different cultures, you know?
Right.
Right. Sing, Johnny.
Look at the girls. Oh, my gosh. Who decided to close up on the chick with the blue dress?
Oh, what? It's okay. Stop that.
She's got a great face for radio.
Oh.
Duncan.
I'm just saying.
You're getting 5 minutes in the corner for that one.
My goodness.
That's okay. It's a 3-hour movie. I'll be back shortly.
Yeah. Go. Well,
speaking of the music in this film.
Yes, Tim.
Nino Rota was nominated for a Best Score Oscar, but that nomination was withdrawn.
Really?
Yes. Apparently, Rota used themes. I'm reading this right now. Yeah. Rota used themes from prior scores, including the films Fortunella, The Clowns, Daniele Cortis, and his oratorio Mysterium in the Godfather score. The director's father, Carmine Coppola, wrote and recorded much of the source music in the film, music that the characters are supposed to be hearing, particularly in the opening wedding scene.
Oh, okay.
Rota was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score, but the nomination was hastily withdrawn when Rota's use of earlier music was noticed.
Oh, wow.
So he and Carmine Coppola did win later for the joint composition of the original score for Godfather 2.
Yes, they did, yeah.
So it's interesting. I remember hearing that there was a nomination, then it was taken away from him.
Oh, here we go. This is where we hear the story about Luca Brasi. And this, you're right about Johnny Fontaine. That's right. So you're right. This is the story about how they did help Johnny Fontaine's contract. It's like, okay, this is the life.
Got their fingers and everything.
And then
is the first time he's letting her in on this side of his family?
Right, and yeah, basically. And then also this is where we find about how bad Luca Brasi is. And usually it's a show, don't tell. But here in this case, the tell is more terrifying than the show.
Right. Because he looked like a total tard earlier, talking to himself and kind of lumbering around.
But the interesting thing is because then it becomes more of a threat because you know just by reputation, this is what he can do.
Right.
It's like, I was going to say, it's like the third man for...
Carol Reed's
the third man when Orson Welles' character, Harry, what's his name?
I don't know, I don't know,
Harry whatever, it's built up until he shows up in the third act and there he is.
I see.
And there's the Don. He's back out there. So.
Mm-hmm. And what's funny is, like, you can see as soon as he walks in, he's in charge. Like, he's not the most popular guy anymore. Now he's walking away with the guy who was the most popular guy.
Right.
I like how they showed. You know, he sort of, without even trying, kind of took control.
Well, it
has to
do with just very clearly what the relationships are.
Totally.
I will say that I'm totally engrossed in the fact that they're establishing a world and the people that inhabit this world. Mm-hmm. I love the pace of it that you're a fly on the wall to get to know all these people.
Yeah, this is...
It's not you know, it's leisurely. I'm breathing in, taking in an entire world here that's being set before me, and I like that.
And it's been 20 minutes already, mm-hmm. and we're still going with it, and we're just
establishing.
It's exactly. I mean, Coppola is just, incredibly talented. A fantastic job. And now, having been introduced to the whole story about how, you know, Johnny Fontaine's career was started and how they helped him, and now, of course, he's coming to him for further help with the movies.
But like what you said, Duncan, everyone's beating his door down today talk to him.
So I know, right?
Because he'll but this is the day. Listen and grant
right,
them.
Exactly. He's barely even at the party.
And like I say, I would not show my face on this day.
Now, of course, if we follow the canon of all this, this is reputedly the mother of Vincent's character in Godfather 3, played by Andy Garcia.
Oh.
This part, of course, gets cut out on TV.
Was that door moving back and forth?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a subtle little thing. You just saw
the impression of the door.
See? Mr. Coppola, you're done good. That was a nice little detail.
It's all about the details, you know.
Well, it is about the details.
By the way, I find this interesting. You see the blinds in the back, how they make a sort of
pill?
Roundish.
Ooh.
all right.
What about the blinds?
Right? That's it's a little like interruption. Very similar
to the design in Star Wars, if you try to
Return of the Jedi, when they go to visit the Emperor.
Yeah, the design.
Same exact.
I thought of that.
And it's no coincidence.
I didn't want to say anything, but thank you.
Right.
Okay, we brought it up. Okay, all right.
I wonder if that influenced, though.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't think
so. The Emperor's basically the godfather of the whole galaxy. Just saying.
Okay, Return of the Jedi is not the godfather.
Coming back to this.
This is much better film.
My bad.
This Return of the
Fair enough.
Not Return of the Jedi.
Are there Ewoks in the Godfather?
Oh, no. Now we're going down a very bad path. Oh, no.
Okay.
Please,
I started it. I'm officially in.
There are no Ewoks. There are no Ewoks in the Godfather.
I'm waiting for him.
There is no Jar Jar Binks.
I'm waiting.
In the Godfather.
I know they're around the corner. But the lighting does make great sense in this.
There are no
mentions.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you see, now actually they've opened the blinds, so now it's getting lighter in the office.
Yes, yes, yes. I see more of the set.
Look at Brando. Brad is awesome. And he was not an old man. He was in his 40s.
Yeah.
He was in his mid-40s.
Yeah.
So they aged him up a few.
Okay, now
notches.
that cake will indeed, as Vito Scotti said, make his daughter fat. Holy cow, look at him.
It's making me fat just looking at him.
Right? Look, Vito's very happy. He's very happy with his cake.
Right.
And there was a nice key light on him.
If you had to choose...
Oh, I like this. I like that he says, give him a living. Give Polly a living, but don't make him important.
Oh, parameters.
Well, yeah. But this is where you're starting to see, you've seen the elegance of how, Vito Corleone's basically built his business in a way of how to control and navigate and manipulate everyone.
Well, hence the logo.
The logo, the puppet master.
Which is a little close to My Fair Lady, but I'll let it slide.
I think it's much more telling in this one, in a nice, darker way.
Well, they're not exactly the same film either.
Oh, I know.
If you had to say Godfather 1 or Godfather 2, would you say one is
greater,
better than the other?
I think they're different.
I've always been told there's, as far as sequels are concerned, you can't beat
it's the greatest.
Godfather
I think
2.
It's the greatest sequel ever. Maybe it can compete with Empire, but Empire, once again, it's a different kind of sequel.
Was this written with the intention sequel after?
I don't think so.
Then that makes Godfather 2 all the more incredible, right?
Oh, yeah. I think they're just two great films. I mean, they both won the Oscar.
Yeah, back to back.
It just shows. No, 2 years apart.
Oh.
73 was The Sting.
Okay.
Beating out The Exorcist.
So that was our wedding sequence.
And now this is essentially, I guess if you want, the second act. In a way, it's not very conventional, and this is all stock footage.
Look, Hollywood Land still up there on the hill.
Oh, really? Right. It's all stock footage. That's Franklin.
That's the United Methodist Church down there.
That's La Cienega. Yeah.
Highland. Crescent
Man's Chinese.
Highland.
Hollywood Boulevard.
There's Man's.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Highland sure has changed.
And Waltz International, but you know I pass that every day.
Right.
Actually, I'm sure you do, but it doesn't say that. Where is the shot?
What lot
is
that?
This is the Bronson Gate nowadays.
Oh, it is.
That stage
okay,
to the left is where they shoot Dr. Phil nowadays.
Yeah, this is all backstage on a lot of
so they use Paramount.
They had the big fire.
Yes. Yeah, this is all second unit stuff.
Yeah, that's stage 8 and 9 are on the right down there. That's where they shot a lot of Star Trek stuff.
Later. Hmm. Sweet.
Straight stage 18.
I used to work at Paramount.
Stage 18 is one they used for all the Star Trek stuff
yes,
as well.
18
right?
is right across from 8 and 9. 8 and 9 are sort of joined together with the dressing room building attached on one side.
Okay.
And then 18 is right across the street. Enterprise, okay. The show I worked on, was on all three.
Okay. Yeah, this was shot on the stages where they shot this. Literally. Just
mm-hmm.
backstage.
That'll work.
Totally.
And this is the director with the pipe, right?
Yeah. I think his name's John Marley.
I wonder who he was modeled after.
Kind of looks like Ian McKellen.
Oh. John Marley. Yeah, I think it is John Marley. I love that light
stage
bulb.
Light.
Look at that. Stage light is right there, and they just go right by it.
Elephant door. No, that's not elephant door. No.
It's like I've heard this 1,000 times.
I wonder all the mob stories in Hollywood in the 40s.
I don't know.
What year is this supposed to take place?
This is, I think, right around the time, end of the war, towards the end of the war.
Okay.
45 mostly. I like how Hagen is just really calm and cool, and that guy is just like, you know, unloading on him, and it's like, and he's just smooth as silk.
Right.
Now,
this was shot at my house. I'm just kidding.
Duncan,
the guest house or the main house?
Well, this
is just the guest house.
The interesting thing is, of course, I mean, we're watching the movie, the motion picture of The Godfather. There is the Godfather saga, which essentially was Coppola created it for TV back in the 70s, taking the first two and then adding footage that never made it in.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And
expanding.
One thing that was in these scenes that we never saw was the fact that whatever this producer actually had was keeping this, I guess, young actor, underage girl in his house.
So they had something on him because of that?
Basically, yeah. Basically, it was implied that, you know, he was basically shtupping the underage girl. I mean, with the mother's permission. The mother was letting her. This is in the Godfather saga. This guy, the producer.
Oh.
I mean, when I say underage, you're like 16 or something like that. But still, I mean, the idea is that essentially the mother was pimping her out to try and advance her career with this producer.
Mm.
But that's not in this film.
Interesting.
So you're saying as far as cutting, so the amount that was shot is compared to what wound up to be in the final cut?
Well, I think where they wound up taking stuff out for whatever reason.
I'm surprised, like with the Blu-ray or something, if they wouldn't with all the outtakes.
I think Coppola's attitude was that it would go into the Godfather saga. Likewise, there's a scene in Godfather 2 that got cut where you see the guy who essentially set up the whole thing with Michael's wife getting killed. You see his car get blown up, which doesn't appear in Godfather 2.
Mm.
Ah, oranges. Coppola always uses oranges in his films, or at least some of his films, as a symbol of death.
Really?
Yes, it does. In fact, if you watch, I think it was a John Grisham film that he did with Matt Damon. He uses oranges. Actually, no, it was the oranges or pyramids in that one. But it's really interesting. In Godfather, at least, they represent death.
Well, being California and being...
Well, no, in New York. In other words, this is the only California scene.
Okay.
In the New York scenes, there's definitely...
Do they have oranges in the New York scenes?
Oh, yeah. Well, remember at the end with how when he's playing in his little orchard and he takes the orange and puts it in his mouth?
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole oranges death
thing. Because I'm saying this is California, oranges, that makes total sense.
But it's,
that,
I mean, but it's very intentional.
It's through the rest of the film that the oranges appear as well.
Okay. This guy, I mean, that's great. I mean, you just stay on that and then he just cuts to Hagen. Hagen's just eating. And then, of course, we just cut to this, the mansion. Mm-hmm. This is great. I mean, this is a great suspenseful scene.
Because you're like, something's going to happen.
Something's up. Okay, there's the pan with quiet. The zoom. This is Rollick's at the zoom.
A lot of dissolves.
Because they're done well. Oh, the sun's coming. Look, that's the sun is coming mm-hmm. up right behind the tree.
And they're shooting into it. That's,
well, yeah.
That's another like risk-taking thing. Impressive.
And this is great. It's a doll. Now this is the Dolly Inn, and it's just all so slow and subtle. It's great. I mean, of course, when the film came out, when the book came out, this was a big thing. Actually, I think in the book, the horse's head was on the end post. It was in the movie that was different.
And to course, reveal it this way. And in the movie, it's a much creepier, much more impactful way to do it because you're in bed with it. It's right there next to you.
Like, and that means like, someone came in there in the night and put it there. Not
exactly. And it's very subtle. Here he is. I mean, we just start getting the little clues.
There's, and then we think it's his blood, obviously. We're like, guys, bleeding to death.
And then, of course, we're discovering before him and then with him.
Music cue. Listen to this cue. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, the
reveal,
music,
reveal.
The music's not manipulating us at all. No.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. I like how it takes
the... Because you're totally vulnerable in bed, so...
Right. He doesn't know if he's injured or what's going on.
Oh.
It's like the horse in Mr. Ed.
Oh, man. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, to see its neck.
With just a...
Well, and isn't that a real horse head?
It actually was. They did go to a factory where they actually, kill horses to make essentially dog food, and they said, okay, well, we'll take a real head.
Do we know the actor's name that played the director?
I think that was John Marley.
Kudos to him, doing a scene with a decapitated horse head in a bed.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So now this is where we all, we had a little bit of business from before that was set up, and now we get onto the real business.
So are we
of the film? In other words, before we had an idea of like what the Godfather is capable of in terms of structure. We had the whole introduction to the family, and now what this is how they run the business. And now we have them intersecting with this is how we do business with other people and other people wanting to do business, and they get caught up in this whole other essentially another other plot, which is now we see, and that's I guess this is the true beginning of the second act. Okay. So in a way, it's kind of, it odd little structure, but we kind of go with it.
So are we at 34 minutes right now?
Yeah. So this is
so it was 34 minutes before a impact scene, which was the horse in the bed.
Well, that was at about 28, 29, impactful, and that tells us essentially everything you need to know about Vito Corleone. And now we get onto the story of what's going to happen to the Corleone family, which is where this all starts now. And Hagen basically lays it all out.
Is Duvall in Godfather 3?
No. I don't know what the deal was there, but John Savage plays his son. And it's a very small part. I mean, it's not impactful in the story at all, but he is there. Like how Jimmy Conn's just, I'm eating. What are we doing?
Paramount was having some heavy hitters. Chinatown was, 74. 72, 74, 70, and 74 was Godfather Part 2.
Godfather Part 2, yeah.
Wow, Paramount was doing amazing. Robert Evans and that whole time.
Oh, cooking. I think he's known as the Turk. So now they're trying to make a business deal. mm-hmm. A business deal about running their criminal enterprises.
It's all about business.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole thing. I mean, is the American, the American
everything
dream.
Could be turned into a business,
right? Well, and think about it. You immigrate here from somewhere else. You have nothing. I mean, someone offers you like stacks of cash or even mm-hmm. what to you feels like stacks of cash for something to make a business deal or whatever. And you don't even have to really, as far as do anything that's really bad.
If you can't get connected to the normal mainstream of the right. land that you've come to.
Or don't know how, or you get an offer from from other sources first. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but I think this also grows out of what was going on in Italy, because essentially, I mean, Sicily, and these structures just started translating when people came over from there to here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, no.
I mean, so it wasn't created only here. It's
no. These things. I mean, these things existed before in Italy. Actually, I think the expression. Pardon me. The expression mafia. Now this has to do with the mafia, but the expression mafia actually is I'd heard this once upon a time. Is actually MAF means mort au français, death to the French. And I think maybe that had to do with French control of Sicily at some point, and basically this is a way for the local people to establish themselves in some kind of way against that. Mm. I don't know. I don't know what if that's true or not, but I thought that was interesting. So,
I'm not saying that, yes, all this mafioso, everything that's going on here is only native to America or something. I understand right. that. But I think the seeds of what they brought over are being Americanized, right, into the commercialism of American business.
Oh, what you're saying in here, basically they're Americanizing the whole thing in terms of making it more business-like and everything.
Well,
that's details. That
I don't know.
They're taking, mafia foundation and turning it into the great American capitalistic machine that they're going to infiltrate and turn into mafia business.
Yeah,
because it's leaking into all different areas.
I don't think you can separate that or draw it out from just the idea of making more money, making a good living for yourself, supporting your family, and just living life the way that you see that you want to live it. You know, I mean, is that capitalist or is it just human nature?
No, this is so this is how we know that Johnny got the part. But there, I mean, basically, you know. In that scene, essentially, Sonny spoke against the family. Well, didn't speak against the family. He spoke out of turn. And, you know, Vito had to straighten, you know, essentially his heir apparent out to say, you don't talk against the family. You don't contradict what I'm saying. So. But this is great. I mean, this is great maneuvering. I mean, here you have just such a fine level of, you know, he's essentially asking Luca Brasi to pretend like he's become a double agent, but such a fine level of deception and understanding the machinations essentially of what is going on, of which you normally don't see in American cinema, which is part of the brilliance of this. Okay, I like the fake snow. Okay, I don't.
Why don't you?
Because it's fake snow and it looks like fake snow.
Really?
I like how they took the music cue and just carried it over into the radio thing.
Which to me says it's all happening at the same time.
Right. Well, it's beautifully. And here he puts on his bulletproof vest. So you know he's... But that also comes up later. We see it.
I like how they've got the revolver in the foreground there, too.
Oh, yeah, nice. Of course, Gordon Willis did an amazing job with all this.
And didn't he do an orange filter for the whole film?
That
I wouldn't
don't
be
know.
Surprised. It kind of looks like it.
I don't know.
To give it that earthy, antique-y look.
It's important. He's, you know, we have a piece of information. Polly called in sick. Just little things. I mean, this seems like it seems to be nothing, but this is great use of suspense. Like, oh, he's just leaving. Oh, you know something's going to happen.
It's that type of a film where you do realize through the craftsmanship that no scene is just for nothing.
No, everything is there intentionally.
Is there for, yes.
Everything is
great
there
hallway.
Intentionally. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this was shot in L.A. L.A., in New York in some hotel.
A lot of reflections. Oh, it's a tough place to shoot.
And look, he's all dark. Luca Brasi went to complete black.
Silhouette.
It was awesome.
It is a great look.
I got to tell you, this was reminding me so much of when I first saw this in that film class, and I'd heard so much, and you kind of... And now look, we're looking through it, and we're looking at fish.
Which means?
Well, because the whole thing... Oh.
Chinatown reference.
No. That's a Godfather reference, because basically when I have to say, you know, Luca Brasi is swimming with the fishes.
Really?
Already,
I'm missing things.
Visually, we've been given the clue.
Wow.
And there's Salazzo.
Nice.
And watching this in the film class, it was great because I'd heard all these things. I'd heard about this scene, but I'd never seen it. And it's like I can still feel the first time I saw it. It's really interesting. Like that look. Mm-hmm. You just know something's just not right. But I mean, this guy's as tough as they come, so of course, you know.
Now, I noticed they haven't indicated a year here. This is just implied to take place in present day.
No, this is
like 40s.
This is 1940, 1945, 1946.
Okay.
This is right war into war. I love this. He leans in.
Yeah, if you look at the cars.
I like how he just looks over his shoulders. He knows something is wrong.
Right. I mean, it's unsettling. It's all unsettling.
Little clue. Brilliantly.
Ooh. So much for the bulletproof vest.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is horrible. And look, I like how he goes right beneath the shoulder. You know, they just let him drop. Mm-hmm. And basically, I mean, in terms of military strategy, they're taking out the biggest enforcer. Oh, man.
He's going to be hanging by his hand?
Well, for a second.
Yeah. Oh.
And then here... I mean, basically, they make all their moves at once. And now they basically kidnap Tom.
You know what quote I'd apply to this film?
What's that? What's going on with Santa Claus? Yes.
Tony Bennett's from the Oscar. You lie down with the pigs, you wake up smelling like garbage. Yeah.
And then here, you know, simple little scene. And we've seen John Cazale. We saw him in the wedding scene. And, you know, we saw him drunk, actually. And what does he get? He gets...
Oranges.
Oranges.
Yeah, this is a big set piece. That's right. Right? I'm trying to recall this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
It's not big, but it is a set piece. Oh, I never noticed before. There's a guy who's basically practicing on the trumpet in the background.
Right.
And now, of course, we have two guys with their hands in their pockets. Oh, geez. And he knows what's going on. And it happens really quickly. Oh, wow, look at that.
Oh, gosh.
That was 11 shots. And John Cazale, I mean, basically, he can't even hold the gun. And the trumpet stopped. And all he can do is cry.
Yeah.
I mean, it just shows his emotional temperament as compared to his other brothers. Mm-hmm. I mean, where he stands. The Bells of St. Mary. I guess this place isn't like in 45 or 46, yeah.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
That's interesting, you know, in an age of instant communication now.
That was beautiful. Yeah. Did you see what they did right there? I'm sorry to cut you off.
Oh, no, so go ahead.
Would you like me if I were a nun? Her face is completely up. She's flirty. She's smiling. You pass the newsstand, which is out of focus in the foreground.
Right.
Her face is completely fallen.
Right.
He didn't see the newsstand. She did.
Yeah.
And she takes him back to the newsstand to see the news. That was wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that.
I personally was totally distracted by the fact that she might have been upset about him saying Ingrid Bergman. Yeah.
That's what you thought?
Yeah.
Because I'm like her. I was going to comment to say she's a cartoon. She went from cute, flirty to ashen, fallen. Why'd she do that? It's comical, but it's because she saw the paper.
Yeah, she saw the headline. That's how subtle it is.
That I loved how subtle that was, for a reveal. Oh, but that was very good.
But once again, it's like when the guy looked over Luca Brasi's shoulder, you know, knowing it's just like the littlest clue.
That's very clever.
He's got to search for his gun. Good grief.
Well, yeah, I thought he was getting a clean pair of underwear.
Yeah, that too.
There you go.
When was Brian's song? Was Khan pretty well known at this point?
I think Brian's song was before this, I think. I think it was like 70 or 71. Brian's song was a...
TV movie.
TV movie about...
Did you ever see that?
Brian
Duncan?
Piccolo.
Which one?
Brian's song.
No, I've heard of it.
It was famous at the time because it was a really good film. I think it won an Emmy or something like that. And he played a football player who died. That was with Billy Dee Williams? No.
Yes.
It was Billy Dee Williams as his best friend.
Yeah, I believe it was.
And that kind of put, and it was, you know, like for a TV movie, that was really big.
Mm-hmm. That was the first thing that I knew that put Khan in the spotlight, I think, as far as career-wise.
I have this memory of looking at TV Guide and seeing, you know, the preview or, you know, remember how they used to have in TV Guide?
Yeah.
Yeah, this thing's
coming, yeah.
It's so creepy. It's like, I think it's like an abandoned diner.
Right. Now, timeline-wise, I find this fascinating. Basically, these guys made a news story happen on a newspaper on the same day that they did it before they did it.
Well, that's the thing is papers came out more than once a day back then. In other words, there was like an afternoon edition. You know,
it literally can't be more than a couple of hours since they...
Oh,
got him, and he's still sitting there in his coat and hat.
Yeah, this is at night. Yeah,
yeah. So that fast, really?
Oh, like Baltimore used to have the morning sun and evening sun.
I guess that would have been the fastest way of communication then.
Well, that was the only way of communication, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, this is pre-TV. So all you had was radio and newspapers, newspapers are just jamming it out all the time.
Okay.
Oh, there was totally an evening edition. So it is believable that by then it would have gotten in there.
Do you know, as far as screenplay wise, was this locked or did rewrites as they were shooting? Was it a mishmash, a patchwork in how it came together, or was the script pretty locked?
I think once they got it worked out, I mean, they might have been rewriting as it was going, but I mean, he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He would work with, I think, Mario Puzo to get some stuff, but I mean, in the basic direction was all there. But I think there was a matter of like, well, we can't shoot this and we can't shoot this, but we don't have enough money, we don't have enough time. The studio was definitely on him to get stuff done.
I mean, I'd be interested to know if it was chaotic due to, for whatever reasons, the studio was like, we're going to pull the plug unless you do this, let's shut down, bring it back up.
Well, there was a lot of that. If you listen to the Coppola's commentary, you get a good taste of that and read, I think there's like one or two documentaries and you could read stuff.
Was Paramount pretty nervous over this film?
For a while they were, until they saw the scene with Michael and the police chief in Salazzo, which was shot actually in the first week, and that made them feel a little better. And then when he won the Oscar for Patton, made it a little better. But all through the film, there was like rumors of that, where they're going to replace him and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
But you know, he got through it, finished it off. It's now
legend.
Iconic. I wouldn't say classic; it's not even good enough. Yeah, exactly. A legend, iconic, probably one of the great American films.
What people don't realize is you see something that looks so good and so right,
and
you don't understand the conditions under which it was made.
It was,
you know.
Here you go. What does he say?
That's great. You can see their breath.
Adonis Donna's still alive. So basically, he's cornered, you know, basically Hagen to say, make the deal, because now that Don's still alive, they have to do that. What were you asking me?
I didn't. It was a statement. He's got a taillight out. He could get pulled over for that.
That's right. What was the statement?
The statement was that people see something in hindsight, I mean, something that has become a masterpiece, something that looks so right in its pacing, its craftsmanship, how it's put together, and not to realize the chaos it was created in.
Oh, sure. What I want to say about that is this was a low-budget film. This did not have a high budget. I mean, it definitely was low budget.
It was considered a low budget.
And then they went over budget somewhat, but still a lower budget film. So it was like, well, we have to get this done whatever way we can. And they really did an amazing job. And you think, oh, yeah, this was a big budget. Now, Godfather 2.
That's very impressive.
Whole different deal. They had enough money, and they did what they had to do.
They had the kingdom then.
And they didn't blow it. I mean, everything definitely did, as Coppola will say on the commentary, went up on the screen.
I love that lighting. That's beautiful.
And but look at the composition, too. Mm-hmm. How the three
of Duvall,
them.
Look at Duvall off screen.
Michael is in the foreground looking the other direction.
Yeah.
And they're all like talking amongst themselves. And look what Michael does. He gets behind the desk. It's like a little foreshadowing.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
But no one would ever think that he would take over the family. And of course, while Sonny's alive, it would never be considered.
That's right.
Sonny, nice placement of the chair to be on the phone.
But clearly, Michael's the one with the brains to actually do it. That's the thing. And, you know.
Right.
Sonny could never. I mean,
he's reactive.
But that's the thing. Sonny was in charge, and he managed to get himself killed. That's the whole thing. There you go. It's 1946.
He said almost.
Okay, it's 1945.
When was Dog Day Afternoon? 73?
75.
Okay, so.
Oh, that was after, definitely, yeah. There's Pauly.
I'm just trying to place people in their careers, so Pacino was really fresh out of the gate, film-wise.
This was Pacino's big break, yeah. Now, Coppola had worked with him, I think, in one or two things. Like this, like, yeah. Pauly, he's like, yeah. See, that's it. Yeah.
That's pretty calm.
See, they don't want to get. They want to get Michael involved. What's interesting? Okay, so now we're watching the transition. I mean, this is important because Al Pacino has not been the central character at all, but now we're seeing the tiniest hints. Okay, there we go. Here's now. You see, remember he was wearing the bulletproof jacket. And Sicilian message. Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes. So now you know definitely. So Michael's not gonna stop.
Well, I was joking about it being a Chinatown reference because remember Houston and Jack Nicholson eating the fish in Chinatown.
Uh huh.
And we were saying it's connected to the water.
Oh,
water
that's right.
That's why I brought that up.
Okay, that's right. I like the hairnet she's wearing. What the heck?
Right.
Nice choice.
Oh,
you don't see enough hair nets in cinema.
No.
Someone's going to bring it back.
I know, I miss them.
Now here, in terms of like, you know, the elegance of things, you know, here, you know, they're talking about going to the mattresses and now they're going to drive all around town. Now this was extended also in the Godfather saga, where what they had is actually in the middle, he stops and has Pauly wait out in the car while he goes in and he eats like a whole meal, which I thought was a nice little touch. But here, of course, you know. And, of course, I like the fact that he says, you know, watch out for the kids when you're pulling out. That's a great Brooklyn. And if you've ever been to Brooklyn, that's totally Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Now,
probably
that looks like
Universal
stock
somewhere.
Footage right there. That's
well,
stock,
that's stock
footage from something.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally just blown up to be 185.
Same for that.
Oh, no, that's definitely stock
that?
Footage.
Yeah.
For 1945.
That's a lot of set dressing if it's not stock footage. But I'm impressed for what you said for being budget-wise considered a low-budget picture. This is shot.
See, I like how the
A-list. Look at the Statue of Liberty there.
Exactly. Notice that already. They introduced visually
through the fields of grain.
Well visually, you know, the whatever those little Russians. They introduced that in the previous shot and in this shot. with the Statue of Liberty. And of course, what do we have? We have a guy pissing on film, which we don't see. But it's like, what the hell? I mean, you don't see this. And of course, he's doing that while, what do we see? And we're just waiting.
Oh.
Crack. And look at the regret on his face. Like, he knew he had to do it, but it's like, damn.
That would cut me off midstream.
No, it didn't. I like this. Take the cannoli.
There's a quote.
Oh, totally.
I see the crew. Look at the reflection in the car window, lower left-hand corner.
Oh, my God, yes, in the window right there.
Oh, my God, you're right.
That's right. Oh, I didn't see that. No.
Wow.
No, I didn't see that.
Crew.
Okay, so now we see Michael.
With headphones. One guy was wearing headphones.
Now we see Michael.
With a Nagra.
Sitting there by himself, isolated. You know, he's still not the central character.
Mm-hmm.
He's still an incidental character in all this, and we're 58 minutes in.
Well, it's only a third of the way through the movie, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of eating in this movie. I'm hungry.
Well,
it's a big part of Italian culture.
And a lot of smoking, too.
Well, I can do without that.
You can't say it in front of the guys.
Like, no, I'm not going to say it in front of everyone else. Okay, so looking at this, I can see how now this is, in a way, a transition phase for Michael.
Right.
Going
right.
from being uninvolved, you know,
to involved.
My family, to he's on the outskirts of right now. It's like, I'm not being involved, but I'm like around this because I want to find out what happens with my father, and there's not much else I can do right now.
Yeah, for one's conscience, where is the limit where you say I'm not involved compared to where you realize?
Well, especially when it's, you know, he's already so deep. It's his dad.
Well, but he's not involved. He's not. He doesn't do anything.
As far as making the decision, you know, and tugging on the heartstrings, that makes it. That's a whole new level. That's not just a business decision,
right? Blood is thicker than water.
Well, you see, now you have the word on Polly. And see, he's just doing, like, I'm doing the family thing. I like that he says, yes, sir. Now, this was shot, just so you know, what's called poor man's process, which means you shoot in the studio, you have a bunch of grips kind of moving the car, and it's black, and then they're moving, essentially, lights behind it. And, of course, it works very well.
It wouldn't look so good in the daytime, but for nighttime stuff, fine.
Yeah, daytime, I think you'd see the guy standing. There.
That would be poor filmmaking
dork.
To do that same process.
That's
and super
after,
a daytime
that's
shot.
That's not poor man's process. That's poor man's
and
filmmaking.
After all that it's shot, all that shooting in that hallway with all those reflective surfaces, and it was perfect, they get, you know, hosed by a car window.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, they...
what's
after,
that about?
After Gordon Willis is so proud of his hallway.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Avoiding reflections in one little thing.
It's not as bad as I think I've mentioned before. In The Sentinel, which was with Christina Raines, the one from the 70s, about someone who's guarding like the gate, it turns out the gate to hell. There's a shot at a funeral where the car goes by. Literally, it's all the whole frame, and you see the entire crew reflected. I mean, you see everybody. Very bad.
It's so basic. Such a
reflections are tough.
Rookie mistake.
Well, also, you know, Video Village plays a big part in
and
that.
And there was no Video Village at that time. In '72, there wasn't.
That's a good point.
I mean, it was
they're
just,
really, because they didn't have video technology
it was
on
just
set.
Just the cameraman at the time. Well, Jerry Lewis, I think, had developed video assist by them. I don't think it was in wide use at all.
Yeah, no, I think that would have been what, like the early, late 70s, early 80s?
Get that Trivial Pursuit question. Jerry Lewis.
It was Jerry Lewis, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because he would act in his films and he'd want to see what he did.
That's amazing. I mean, I know he's, you know, complete ass, but in his personal life. But at the same time, you can't deny he's sort of like Bruce Lee. He's cocky because he knows he's got it.
Well, and in his early career was brilliant. You know, I mean, and it was of the time too. I mean, his work with Dean Martin, but then his own stuff in the 60s. Now this is great. And now, okay, so now watching it with Michael, I'm watching it, and he's just visiting his father. And it's just part of what he's doing, and everyone's gone. And he's like, okay, now I'm figuring stuff out.
Right. Let me ask you something. Did they mention whether he went to college and did that through the military or whether he actually went for a tour or what he did?
He did both. He went to college and he was in the military. So
right.
In other words, he's the college educated. Later on, I wanted you to, be governor, senator.
I understand.
Yeah.
That's not my point. What? My point is I noticed his uniform earlier. He's in the Marine Corps and he's a second lieutenant.
Right.
That would have been the rank that you get when you come out of college, but it doesn't mean he's combat experienced.
Apparently he did have combat experience.
He did.
That's
okay.
The whole thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then he's like a certified badass then.
Well, no, but
he's
that's the thing.
Devil dog.
He's a certified badass, but he's just like, I'm just back home and I'm living my life, just trying. And it so happens that my father is a gangster, a mobster, so.
And see, he's kind of afraid.
He's afraid his father's dead.
Of what he's going to find. Now.
Exactly. And because the
sliding
everything is empty. And I love this, how it's once again, this is Gordon Willis shooting through doors. If you watch, he always loves shooting through doors. Hmm. And we don't even see her face, but we know, So now he knows something, he knows what's up. And he's taking control. That's it. Well, for at least
leadership
of the situation right
abilities
now.
Abilities from his military training.
Yeah. Exactly. He doesn't panic. He's like,
ooh. Didn't even pay attention to her.
But I like how he hesitated just a bit. She's like,
I don't remember this scene.
Oh, this is a classic, classic sequence.
And this is sort of the first step in him getting involved.
Yeah, exactly. Well, before, in other words, he's been hanging out. Now,
he's been able to stand around on the periphery so far.
I'm seeing more clearly now that essentially for the past half hour, he's been
around.
Essentially on the periphery, well, that's 20 minutes and watching, but he's not involved. And he didn't go out to be involved, but clearly he is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking for that one moment you go like, there it is. That's where the switch went.
The point of no return.
Well, the point where he says, this is who I am now. And that's the whole thing. It's him essentially establishing his identity. Well, one part of his identity.
Right.
Essentially the going into it, because then there's a second part.
I have a hard time believing there wouldn't be more. People
what?
Around,
but
as
that's
far
the
as patients and other doctors.
Well,
and,
they arranged it.
They arranged
it's
it
late at night.
Yeah, and also the police came by to send everyone away. But that's because the police are in the bag of
well,
of the
sending Tataglias. The people who don't belong there away. I understand, but the people that are occupying the hospital,
Enzo the baker. So now Michael's thinking. Oh, look at that lighting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that low key lighting from bottom left. See? There it is. I'm with you.
Nothing subtle about that.
Well, because in the way he sees, now here, the interesting, I've always thought, because there's a tear, I think there's a tear that comes down. Is the Godfather happy or not happy that he's with him? Because he wanted him to be governor. He wanted him to be senator.
Right.
There
he's smiling, though.
So he's happy that he's with him? Because essentially Michael sees that Sonny could maybe handle it, but he knows in his mind, he knows what to do.
Yeah.
Like Enzo. He has no idea what he's getting into.
I know, right? Poor Enzo the baker.
Like, get rid of the flowers. And now this is where his military training comes in.
Mm-hmm. Make the enemy think something that's not true.
But also, also in terms of nerves, because learned to basically conquer his nerves. Mm-hmm.
He keeps calm, he thinks, and he makes command decisions.
Right.
Yep.
I like this sequence very much.
I like how the car just comes up. And he was smart because now he makes them believe that there's still people there, so they mm-hmm. can't basically mm-hmm. go inside. And that's all he does. He puts his hand in his jacket. It's like, okay. He's basically made them believe that mm-hmm. there are more. Everyone's mm-hmm. there.
Or at the very least, that they're going to get a firefight in the street just to get in.
And this is a great punctuation. Oh, okay. He can't hold a cigarette straight.
Yeah,
that's what I'd be doing.
Exactly, and he can't light it. And watch what Michael does.
Yeah, first time.
He just does it first time, and he looked at his hands. His hands are calm.
Mm-hmm.
He's not shaking.
Right. Well, you know, if he saw action in World War II, especially later in the war, that would have been ugly stuff.
Yep.
Ugly stuff.
And this is Sterling Holloway.
Interesting. Another character reveal based on the light.
Yeah, basically. And then this is already an hour 10.
No, that's Sterling Hayden.
Oh, Sterling Hayden? Oh, I'm sorry. Sterling Holloway's right, Sterling Hayden.
I recognize his voice.
Yeah.
And his face. That's Sterling Hayden.
Sorry.
King of film noir.
He was actually considered for Jaws, for Quint.
But yeah.
He couldn't get a visa.
Sterling Hayden.
That's Sonny Grosso, one of the guys that The French Connection was based on.
Oh.
Yep. Ooh. So basically he's tied it to the Turk.
Oh.
Yeah, this is before Miranda rights and everything.
Right.
Ooh.
That'd be all over YouTube today.
Right? Well, that guy loses his job the next day.
I don't know about that. Mm.
Well, at the very least, there'd be like lawsuits filed in 10 minutes.
Well, yeah, there would be. And of course.
One of those police.
Now, this is like mm-hmm. a little too convenient, of course. You know, they came just as he was leaving, and now they come just as mm-hmm. that.
The timing.
Then, yeah. Everything else.
I'll give it that.
Everything's been kind of.
It worked fine
timing.
For me.
See, that's what's great to have essentially your lawyer. Nice music cue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was nice strings.
I like it. Yeah. I like how there's a compound and everything.
Right, and they've got like a car as a barricade through the door.
What?
They've got a car as a barricade to even get through the gate.
Yeah, exactly.
It's because, yeah. Okay, now we're seeing some heavier firepower.
Things are escalating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So far, I've just seen little tiny 2-inch 38s. Mm. Exactly.
Well, kind of ironic. It's like, well, what kind of operation do you think you're running?
Yeah. Well, Sonny is obviously like drunk on the power and also like too high on the testosterone to run this thing. All he's about is
he's a reactive.
He's a hothead,
of course.
But he's shown that he's a hothead even at the beginning. You know, with the whole thing with the photographer and everything.
Yeah.
That's where that comes from.
There was some ADR involved in that last line.
Yeah. Mm. Well, his head was turned almost as I could do that. This is awesome. Look at that. It was just great. It's watching the dynamic, and this dynamic of brothers, too. And the interesting thing is that, you know, John Cazale's character is not in, Fredo is not in these meetings.
Yeah.
He's just not. And now, basically, it's not exposition-y. Hagen can do this because he's essentially laying out the argument that we're saying, well, this is what, you know, can happen. He's letting Sonny know this is what's going to happen if you do this, if you do that, if you do that.
He supplied us with a lot of good info.
Absolutely.
For the
filled in everything that we needed to know that we've only really seen. I like how Abe Vigoda is just, like, standing in the background.
They use a lot of foreground people off to the sides, I noticed.
And I just like how here how Michael is just, you know, he's sitting there calmly, and he's got it figured out. That's the whole thing. But he's still respecting the power structure. He's respecting there's Sonny. He's respecting there's Tom.
Right.
But then he'll pitch the idea. Of course, why they want to have a meeting with Michael, I don't know. And now we go. I think this
starts to.
It's a dolly in, dolly very in, slow. Yeah. And he's got it all planned out. He wants it to be in public. There you go. See, with the push in right there, and he says he'll kill them both.
And
it's,
you
just like, boom. Yeah?
The push in
was
happened.
Was that your moment?
It's in part two. Go ahead.
You notice the push in happened faster as soon as he said, if you can have a weapon planted there for me. It suddenly went zip.
Yeah.
But I mean, Sarge, was that the moment of.
I think
at
it's,
what
it,
point?
It's one of the several moments. I think there was one before, and then that one is. You're seeing him becoming the Godfather in a way. It's great. It's just another small step, definitely. He's not even being taken seriously by Sonny. His whole mouth is wired shut.
Yeah.
And you see, he's looking at it also in terms of it in killing the cop. I mean, he's saying that it's a crooked cop. Mm-hmm. Someone who's, in terms of this logic, someone who is playing their game in their world. In other words, if you're in that world, you better be ready to pay the consequences within these rules. Mm-hmm. And so he says it's strictly business. Something which, of course, Sonny, you know.
In his conscience, to say it's strictly business.
Right.
With his mouth wired shut like that, he was very much Marlon Brando. To me, the way his mouth is working and his cheeks.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
That's what I thought that was all about.
That too.
That's
nice. And now, of course, he's showing him how to use this particular gun, though. I mean, he should know how to use guns.
In that
family?
Yes, but
I will say.
No, because the military.
I know, but I'm just saying.
That this particular.
I think they're born to know how to use
guns. Oh, that's loud. Well, he wants it to be loud. That's right. Yeah, he says it'll scare anyone else.
Yeah. The shorter barrel guns like that are always louder. Even in smaller calibers. What he would have been trained to use would be a Colt 1911. That's a full-size handgun. This is like a little tiny one, and it's a totally different feel. So he would need a little bit of training on this particular weapon.
Right. Now, this is interesting. He tells him, don't look, and just drop the gun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then basically here, you know, lays out what's going to happen over the next amount of time. That basically they go to the mattresses and, you know, there's going to be essentially a war and clean out. I think he mentions it happens every once in a while to clean stuff out.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I also found it interesting. Here you have essentially, you know, a mobster saying, I mean, I don't know, it just it seems like it's a different world saying they were so proud of him of his military.
Right, but they're, I mean, they're still
But they're Americans. Well, that's their
Americans.
Family and they're Americans.
I mean, yeah, you'd be proud of people for doing that.
That guy we haven't seen before. And it's interesting, actually, how his look is now changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his, like, lips are, well, because his face is swollen. Those are nice Coca-Cola bottles.
Mm.
More food.
It's Chinese food.
Different variety, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, direct overhead lighting is a definite theme in this film.
Yeah.
Because that whole last scene where he's learning the handgun was just one bare bulb above him.
You know what's interesting is, I mean, here they are, they're eating, and of course, it's all looking into the Godfather's office back there and the desk, which is empty. You know, essentially the chair is empty. Like that walk back. It's just, you know, we wait for it. Go Abe Vigoda.
Whose character was Fish?
On Barney Miller. Yep. And Abe Vigoda is still alive.
I'm just saying the whole fish theme.
No, I the fish. I don't know about that. The fish thing came up once. That was looking through the glass.
No, Luca and Brasi, also in the when they unwrapped.
That was the whole thing. Luca Brasi swims the fishes. That was the whole
foreshadowing
point
of
watching looking through the glass. It's saying this is what's going to happen.
It's like he was already swimming in there in a fishbowl with the fish.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
He was dead and he didn't even know it. Well, and Michael just leaves. He's just like,
it's like, all right, you know. I know my part, so here we go.
Yeah. Didn't even read their fortune cookies.
But this bitch's going away. He's not going to see them for a while.
I might have read them earlier.
I don't think he cares.
But we saw by that scene on the step in front of the hospital, if anyone could pull this off, Pacino's going to be up to it.
And that's why he's the one who's like, I can do that.
It's good makeup on him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. On top of which, you know, it's already been established he's not involved.
He's
not.
Oh, he's not.
And he just got roughed up.
Right.
So people, he's basically the... He's, no one's going to suspect.
Right. And he knows that. And that's the thing is, he's worked out, I happen to be in the right place that I can essentially affect my father's revenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will not get away with this, and I will make this work. I can make this work and play my part.
That seemed like they took two separate music cues and blended them together. It didn't. It was not seamless.
Oh.
Interesting.
Actually, it's interesting how this was edited. There's two editors on this. I think William Reynolds edited the first part of the film, and then another editor whose name slips my mind edited the second part, and then they kind of went through and finessed everything.
Hmm.
But if you watch, up until the time when through the Italy part, it seems like it's one film, and then after that, it seems like it's another film.
Hmm.
So basically, for the first 2 hours, it seems like one film. Oh, man, look at him. He's just like, I want to get this over. Hmm. Do not touch me. Now, what had Sterling Hayden done recently before this?
Oh, my God. Well, 72? His height was in the 50s. Hmm. Totally. He did tons of noirs. There's one called Crime Wave. He's really known for that. Didn't he also do The Killers, I think, Stanley Kubrick?
That was The Killing.
Or The Killing.
The Killing, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It looks like a great
Yeah, The Killers
character.
Is Burt Lancaster.
Looks like a great character face.
Oh, yeah. He's always the tough guy.
And real tall.
And what was the one where he played the... I'm drawing a blank. But he did a lot of stuff, primarily in the 50s.
Oh, there's Poor Man's Process again. So basically, I mean, had he done anything in the 60s? Do you remember?
Or I'm not big on Sterling Hayden's career to know, yeah. But in the 60s, I think things tapered off considerably for him.
So in a way, this was, I mean, it's like Brando and Brent, you know, well, less than.
I think it was Sterling Hayden who was in The Star, a movie with Bette Davis that would have been like also late 50s, I think.
Okay, all right.
Mm. No, he was a bankable leading man.
Yeah, and now he was played a bankable character actor.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you watch it, you know, in that context of the time, oh, look, there's Sterling Hayden in the film. I haven't seen him in a while. Or Marlon Brando. Because I remember when the movie came out, it was like the whole thing's like, oh, Marlon Brando's in a film again. I'm like, was he in a film before? You know, I was young, so I had no idea. I was like, his career had gone nowhere. It made, you know, didn't have the context for it, whereas for other people, it did.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do remember this scene.
Okay, I mean, this is a famous scene.
That's why I remember it.
And they shot it in the first week, and this is what the studio, and like, okay, maybe he knows what he's doing, maybe.
And I forgot that I had no idea Sterling Hayden was in this movie. How funny.
I like it. Just Michael is just like looking at him. It's like, I'm playing it cool, but I so want to get this done.
You know what it is? I discovered Sterling Hayden's career after seeing this 15 years ago, so I didn't know who he was the first time I saw this.
So Michael is just like, it's like the anger is just building. I mean, it's not coming out because he will never let the anger dominate him. But the anger is just building and building in him.
And you can see that like the killer light is sort of coming into his eyes. He's sort of getting that 1,000-yard stare kind of thing going on.
He had that going on.
Kind of going into the attack mode.
We had that in the car. That's what was going on there. He's like, mm-hmm. I just want to get this done with. You know, you're talking to me. I know you're dead already.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this, it's like this mental thing that he's going through. Until he does it, it's like he hasn't passed, you know, to the other side, so to speak.
Right.
I love this, that they were talking in Sicilian.
Did they say what happened to Don Corleone's wife, his mom?
She's fine.
Have they shown her?
When Don Corleone was... Yeah. She was in the wedding scene.
Oh, okay.
And I think maybe one
Didn't
other scene.
Didn't notice her.
Yeah, I think she shows up a little later also.
Was she the woman that was singing in
yes.
the wedding?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's Michael's
that
mother.
Was but, a singer? Yeah.
Yes. I love that
Lots
cut.
Lots of coverage.
That cut was awesome.
Yeah.
It was great nice. Because it gives you, it just, it sets it up. Like,
exact opposite, right? It went from one end to the other.
Yeah. It still stayed on the same side of the camera, same side of the line. But it just sets up the suspense for the scene. Look at him. He's just like.
It's a really interesting choice not to subtitle this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, I'm talking English.
I love all the close-up work with everything out of focus around them.
Oh, well, that's the prime lens. Well, it's prime lenses, which I love. You know, shallow depth of field. I love this. It's just like, you know, he's been playing this argument that he doesn't want anything to happen. And he's just like, I'm going.
Extra frisk.
And he's like, I hate your guts so damn much. They shot this actually in the bathroom of the restaurant.
Hmm.
And I think they put in the whatever the this thing with the
pull chain.
Of course. That whole thing they put in. I remember when I saw one of those for the first time and we went to France when I was a kid. I'm like, what the hell is this? And I like the moment. It's like, where is it there? Is it there? And
right.
It's like,
they drag it out.
Well, when he didn't think it was there. And then
I know, but they drag it out for the audience as well.
Absolutely. And then he's got it. Look at that.
We're nervous for him.
This, mm-hmm. I mean, this is just amazing. You just follow it along moment for moment. Brilliant filmmaking. Great use of foreground.
Takes a moment.
Great use of foreground. Yeah, he's... And then also the whole thing of the train. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, well, because it all depends on, of course, the sound of the train coming into the station.
The train of death.
Well, no, the train, just the accentuation. It's like the music, but instead of using music, it's the crescendo of the sound. And here... I like how we crossed from essentially from right to left because we're kind of on the other side of the axis now,
right.
I think. Because before... No, and now we're back on the left side. Oh, I like how that cut. Whoa.
Mm.
It shouldn't have worked, and it did. And it's I like nice. This. It's a push in, and he's just like... You are talking. I'm not hearing you. And the train is coming in. And he's like, well, this is it. It's like what's happening in his mind.
Yep.
The
building,
sound.
Building.
Mm. And that shock, he's like, he's
in the neck. Oh, wow.
The waiter got sprayed.
Yeah, that was pretty graphic for 72.
Oh, yeah. And everyone's just like, what? And he didn't do it. He just like throws it. And you have the great music cue, and he's...
He can never go back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's it. He's in. He is totally in.
You walk in there. Don't order the meatballs.
Right?
And now, of course, you know, we're an hour and a half in, and now we get a montage sequence. But it helps us essentially catch up on everything that's going on. He makes it work.
Mm-hmm. With a very out-of-tune piano.
But I think that's intentional. Actually, when we see the guy playing
when we see the guy playing the
piano, that's actually Carmine Coppola.
Mm.
Yep.
No kidding.
Yep.
See, he's sleeping with a little extra firepower. That revolver on the stand, that was like a 357 or a 44 with a 6-inch barrel.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
that's Carmine Coppola.
Yep. Yes, sir. Barzini. Now this is a way of bringing Barzini back into the into the story. Because Barzini was just in the background before.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the whole thing with the Corleones and the Tattaglias, and now essentially it started a war between the two families.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially the Turk was working for the Tattaglias. And there's the food.
Mm-hmm.
And
he lost some clothes.
Did we have to see that?
Right.
Did we really have to see Richard Castellano's belly? And I like how all this is in the paper. Syndicate big shot returns home. But it's a way of telling. I mean, it's a way of telling the story. It still worked in the context.
It had a noir feel.
It had a noir feel, so in context it works great.
Yeah.
And Gordon Willis. Actually, all those inserts that we saw, all of those were shot by George Lucas. Who was working with Coppola at the time? Absolutely,
no.
Absolutely, all that insert work.
No.
So he was like second unit director. Is what you're saying?
Well, the second unit would be a wider shot and that kind of thing.
Are you serious?
But all the close up stuff that was Lucas. Yeah, Coppola produced THX.
Hmm.
They were working together. Absolutely.
I had no
Lucas
idea.
Originally. We talked about this. Lucas was going to originally direct Apocalypse Now. That was going to be his.
Hmm.
No kidding.
And then he went on.
Well,
to
I know they were all up and comers, you know.
Oh, but
together,
absolutely.
But I had no idea George Lucas had some work in this.
Oh yeah,
goodness, I'm surprised it all hasn't been reimagined, a different montage entirely.
Cut it out. This is Coppola. And look, I mean, he comes home and there's a family and everything. This is a great family film. Look, there's John Kazan, the bottom left hand. Look,
oh, yeah,
look at
finally
him.
We
look,
see him again. We
look
haven't
at him.
Seen
oh,
him.
He's watching his father.
Mm-hmm. We haven't seen him since the shooting scene.
Actually, in the Godfather saga, there was a scene where all the brothers did visit the Godfather in the hospital. Oh, no, either that or no, or it may be a scene here. In the house, I mean. But I don't think it's in this film. Look at all the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I made a mistake and this is the scene. No? Okay, that's where the scene was, and they cut it out.
Which one? Which
when scene? He just when he just closed the door, basically there was a scene where he talked to all of his sons and oh. and to and also to Clemenza. And
now, when you're referring to the Godfather Tessa. Saga, is that like another like it,
no,
release
was,
of this? Or
it's
something?
What Coppola did. He took the two films and cut it for film, and added scenes to it, and including that scene we're talking about. Oh no, maybe it's here. I am mistaken. There we go. And now we're getting more, essentially, this is what's been happening from Tom Hagen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I mean, this is essentially where we're seeing where it's going to, at least with John Cazale's character, Fredo, that it'll lead essentially in the direction of the casinos, which is where Michael takes the business later on. And then, he, of course, you know, Corleone, Don asks about Michael. See, now this is what he's unhappy about. He didn't
want him to get dirty like that.
Right. I mean, basically, he was glad that Michael was with him, but he didn't want Michael. He had his dreams for Michael.
Right.
As he says later, governor, senator. Actually, this is interesting because, Tom's trying to talk about doing business and making money, and all Sonny's talking about is, like, basically having revenge.
James Caan's doing very well right here.
Oh, yeah.
He's very in the moment. If you look at his face and what's going through his mind... played out very nicely.
Actually, the wartime consigliere thing comes up later with Michael and the Don. The fact that Tom, is advising him to just do business as opposed to be able to go to war, which is, I mean, Tom's talent is to be able to do business and maneuver it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes up later when Michael essentially sends Tom to Las Vegas and says, you're out, and my father is basically wartime consigliere because he knows he's got to, essentially go to war.
Oh.
Which is interesting. It's like different aspects of it. And then here you have Fredo, who's, the frailest. Actually, I think we find out in Godfather 2 that basically when he was a child, Fredo was sick a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the Godfather, it was definitely of a concern to his parents. Sicilia. Pardon my pronunciation. I think it is pronounced like that. And they did go to Sicily to shoot this.
Cool.
Much to the chagrin of the studio. No,
that's
I'm
good.
Sure.
It can't be that low budget. That's good.
Don Tomasino, who shows up in actually Godfather 2 and Godfather 3. Hmm. Well, actually, I think a young actor plays him, but I think he actually does, he plays a character again in Godfather 3.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't shoot this in the San Fernando Valley on a shoestring.
It just would not work. And after in Godfather 2, we find out why he limps.
Which is why?
Don Tomasino. Have you seen Godfather 2? Am I spoiling it for you?
No.
Well, then I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
I thought you had seen Godfather. Oh.
I don't think I have, no.
Wow. You totally.
I'm not hooked into the whole Godfather
Dude,
thing.
You got to get the Blu-rays. You got to watch them. I guarantee you a good time, a good filmic time will be had. Look at that.
That's a great
old,
village.
Old city. Village, yeah. City village, yeah. I mean, you can't build a set like this. This is...
No, you'd have to...
See, all the men are dead from Venice. I mean, you know, it's like you go to the... Actually, interestingly, symbolically, they're going, you know, going back to the motherland, but in the motherland, you see what essentially that kind of life has led to. I mean, with all the vendettas, all the men are dead.
That's pretty much what I gathered in seeing the film for the first time, was that revenge, vendetta.
It's interesting.
Everyone dies.
I like how, you know, the two guards, essentially, this is how they differentiate themselves. The other guy's more low-key. This guy's a big mouth. You know, he's like, oh, Americans, hey, come here. Pay attention to me. Apollonia. Bella, bella.
This has a very novel feel to it, that it has the pace of a novel. Rather, I mean, this is an extended sequence. Usually, I mean, this could be cut, right? In today's...
I guess, I mean, once again, it's like the first... In a way, it's like the beginning of the film.
I feel like I'm reading a novel by watching this movie.
Where it took the time to introduce everyone at the wedding, and now here it takes the time to introduce his life.
It breathes, in
Italy, well, in Sicily. Yeah. I like that more dangerous than shotguns. Oh, yes. Well. And then here's the Godfather theme on a mandolin. Just everything is just, it's so well directed and real, naturally directed. It doesn't feel anything's theatrical, which is great. Now, this is great.
Yeah, I do feel like a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
In this.
This is great. I like this. I mean, they come in, he says, hey, talking about the women, and, you know, of course, there's the mouth.
What is he going to turn around and say, that's my daughter?
If you wait 30 seconds, you'll find out. Yes. I mean, it's great. You know, you're talking about the one
guy.
Forget
this part.
Says,
yeah, right.
This one had a purple dress. And look at the guy's face. He's like, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Nice little comic relief with the other guy. And look at him. It's like, nope. Don't know at all.
That wasn't obvious.
It's like, this guy... Now watch this. Hang on.
Get the drink first.
Of course, he's got to get his drink. And he's like, no, it's okay. But there's another little subtlety here. Mm-hmm. But it's great because Michael knows exactly what's going on, and he knows how to handle this kind of situation. I mean, it really shows his executive skills.
Right, totally. Totally. He was totally calm and not involved the whole time.
He's arming himself. He goes in with the gun, and the other guy pulls
the gun.
He's
getting ready.
It's like, oh, we're not going to screw around. And it brings out the two brothers. And it's got a great formal feeling as he has him translate for him. And he's basically, you know, this is laid out for him. It's sort of like, here's a situation. I will now court this girl because it's been handed to me and I want to. And now he knows, uh-oh. Dun, dun, dun. And you see him right there. He's... And I like how he puts the suspenders on. It's like, yes, I... And this is great because he doesn't know her name. And now he knows Apollonia. This is really interesting because he's just met her, so he's seen her, and he's decided, I'm going to marry her.
Right. I mean, it's so old school, you just can't even... It's almost unreal. The kind of... I mean, obviously, that was much more direct than anything would usually be, but... The whole going through the father and through the family and the courtship thing.
But I think that was he saw the opportunity and said, this is how, how to do it. But the interesting thing is, when was the moment when he decided, I'm going to marry her? Because clearly he went into the conversation knowing, that's what I'm going to say. I mean, he didn't like invent it on that spot.
I don't know. That's, I mean, just.
I don't know. Maybe it's the way it was back in 1945.
It's a different kind of approach because you have the whole family involved. It's not as...
High stakes.
It's not the same kind of considerations as we have.
Well, I'm not talking about necessarily the whole thing of how I'm going to court her, but the fact that he decided in his mind that he was going to even say.
Well, but what if he's saying that because that's the formality, because he wants to show that he's serious, but he's just getting to know her. I mean, it's not like he's put a ring on her finger. He could still very reasonably and honorably step away.
Okay, gotcha. In my opinion, once you ask someone to marry them, you better follow through.
Well, he's implied to her father. It's not like he's said it to her yet.
Right.
And the father wouldn't have any reservations based on what he's seen this guy is so far.
Right.
As far as with the guy's packing heat around him, and I'm hiding from America.
Well,
here.
But at the same time, he's got money. He's from a connected family.
And he has power, and he also knows, I mean, what the deal is. It's like...
Plus, he's being respectful to him.
Right. It's not like he's cornering him in any way. And I like how they're having their conversation right there. Of course, he and she have not even talked. They're just looking at each other. And it's the subtle thing. Necklace. It's like, I like the necklace you gave me. Okay, thank you. And then, they get to talk.
I'm just amazed at her ability to walk on that ground with those heels.
Right, but this is great. It comes up, I think, in a second. Hang on. We just see them walk. Oh,
wow, she nice. Doesn't do it see, too well, does she?
And then everyone
right, and everyone else is following
along.
After.
Yeah,
this is the under the supervision of your family part.
Oh yeah.
So, like the FBI taking license plates, people are always watching.
And then, of course, his guys follow behind with their guns. And now we're back in Nueva York. What are they doing?
I don't know.
Has a great period feel.
Oh yeah, sure. They're playing. Oh, I remember what's going on. Look how many guys are with him. It's like eight guys.
Oh, this is the other guy that's on lockdown that's protected?
No, this is Sonny, basically. Oh. Sonny stooping his mistress.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, same chick from the wedding.
Number four. Well, basically, it's Vincent's mother.
Wait, I'm confused. Which one's Vincent?
It's in Godfather Later? 3, Andy Garcia's mother. Okay. Now, you see, I mean, the thing is here, in a way, you see how he operates essentially as operating godfather. And, you know, this is what I do. I screw around on my wife.
Right.
Whereas,
in front of all
these
men.
I mean, Vito Corleone is just like, no, none of that happens. Oh, look at that. That's horrible.
Wow.
Oh, God, look at it. He's...
That moment took a high risk of not playing very well, biting into your hand for a reaction, and yet it played.
It looked like it was on impulse. It's not like he planned it. It's just like that's...
It played.
Yeah.
But
he's a great...
Well, it's a very traditional gesture, too. I mean, that's a European thing, just like the thumbing under the chin and the whole thing. I mean, that's pretty
true.
Common.
True. God, look at his clothes. He should be beat up just for that.
I know, right? Looks like he just escaped from prison.
Oh, summer in Brooklyn. Oh, yeah.
What is the water coming out of?
It's from a fire hydrant.
Fire hydrant.
It's a totally a New York thing. You break the fire hydrant so you have water to run through. Well, it's a city thing is what it is.
This is shot at Paramount, too. And they pull that truck there. That truck is actually blocking you from seeing parts that don't match.
That's Paramount?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
What's blocked in the background is
The Ryan Gold, the beer thing.
It's totally different.
Look at
this. And in that last shot, James Caan missed him by a mile in one of the punches.
Look, it's Thomas Dewey. Oh, this is 48, so we kind of know where this is.
Pulls his shoe off.
When you have nothing left to do, you take the shoe and then you take the garbage can.
And they're just watching him get...
Right.
Because the muscles surrounding him.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't stop. It's like this guy deserves... Oh. And this has been one shot.
Mm-hmm. Well, there it switched.
And he's actually in the gutter. Yep.
Right?
Yep. And the kids are like, you're spoiling our...
The kids should have just gone right back to dancing in the fountain.
I wonder how much time they're suggesting has passed that he's been doing the courtship.
I don't know. I don't think too long, maybe a month. I'd have to take a guess.
You know, you do hear a lot more stories from further back than our modern era about people having really short courtships before they get get married and they stay together forever and ever.
My parents met I don't even know. I think it was within 3 months, 3 to 6 months. They met, they got engaged, married.
Be an interesting.
And it was in the 50s.
And no one
study.
Had heard the term starter marriage. You know that.
I'm not familiar.
You said they stay together. Starter marriage nowadays is your first marriage doesn't have to stick. It's just your starter marriage.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's just an expression that's used looking back on marriages that didn't actually work.
Right.
This is one of Gordon Willis's favorite shots, according to the commentary. But look at it. It's great. It's the whole village, and you just see them going through it.
And everything is shot through a orangish filter.
Because orange is the color of death.
Death. Actually, that is interesting, because Coppola, what was the movie with Bridges and about the car manufacturer?
Tucker.
The orange filter in that whole film?
Coppola. It's been a long time since I saw that film.
You didn't notice an orange? Oh my gosh!
Well, I don't remember. I saw Tucker once.
It's the most orange you'll see in a movie. So I find it interesting. Orange Coppola, orange filter.
You know, just total side note because I'm a gun geek is just the idea of his bodyguards carrying shotguns, especially in a group of people. I mean, first of all, they're very short-range weapons, so someone on a roof just 50 yards away, they probably wouldn't even be able to hit them, and not with enough force to kill them, on top of which it scatters. So if they're close in, they're probably going to hit some of the guests, even if they hit the people.
So it's not a wise gun of choice.
No, it's stupid. And they're walking around in fields with a shotgun like they're hunting. I understand if they're trying to, like, pretend they're hunting, but just not a smart
weapon. Do you think it's just...
Talk about what's happening now.
Well, let's talk about what's going to happen in 10 seconds.
Right.
Actually, she wasn't Playboy back in the 70s.
I could see that.
She did...
After this, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, yes, this brought her some attention. Right. I think she'd been around in Italy before then. That's how she was brought to the attention of the producers. But
how freaky would this be?
That was subtle. I like that, how the hand goes up and we see the ring.
Right. How freaky would this be just conceptually, like, you don't really have much any... physical interaction, then suddenly on your wedding night you're expected to have sex. I mean, like, and that wasn't
but
even you wouldn't even really have resources to know what that was going on unless someone t- told you, and even then.
Basically, that's kind of what it was like for some people. I think that was simple, yet spoke gobloads.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know what occurred.
It was tasteful nudity.
I like how her coat matches the cab. Oh, and it's orange.
Noticed that
the cab was yellow and orange, and her coat is orange.
It's like an alarm. It's like danger, danger.
In the scene of look, it's all very like these are muted. All these muted colors, mm-hmm. and in these muted colors comes Kay with red flowers in the background, and well, okay, her coat's red. All right, damn it.
Look at the trash car in the background.
I know. And actually, she's going to notice, and she's going to be like. What?
That's all I need to say.
Right?
Oh, okay.
It's completely burned out.
Yeah. And he's just being a lawyer. I can't take the notes. Like, oh, great. I think this was one of her first big roles, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm.
I think the...
Yeah.
Oh, of course, now...
Looking for Mr. Goodbar was after this, wasn't it?
Looking for Mr. Goodbar was much later. I think Annie Hall was the next biggest thing, which was in 77. But there were other films before that, in between. I just can't think of them.
I thought Looking for Mr. Goodbar was before Annie Hall.
Really? Oh, I don't know. I mean, Mr. Goodbar, all I can remember is Richard Gere was in that, and sometime...
Wow. This guy's a real dumbass.
He's a major dick.
On top of being a dick, he's a real... I mean, like...
Well, he is.
He forgot whose daughter that is.
Exactly. It's like,
and he just about got killed by her brother.
Well, this is intentional. All this is intentional. Not on her part, on his part.
That's a bad reaction on his part. She just covered him in a bunch of stuff, and he's being very careful about getting dressed. He'd be very upset to be covered in...
Well, but that's the thing, is... See, this is what he wants. He wants this to happen.
I forgot that was part of the...
Yeah, it took me a couple of times watching it to realize this is exactly... I mean, the phone call and everything. Either the phone call, but... It is intentional. Because he is pissed that he got beaten up by Sonny. Yeah, that, a lot of ADR there, but it still works. This is horrible. With the sounds that are coming from the bathroom. Ugh. Look at the bed. There's the bunny rabbit.
And
of course, we cut right to the. we cut to the baby. Just I can't hear you.
And Sonny's going to react
again, and that's what they're essentially. That's the idea. That's what we're counting on. I like it. Look at his shirt is monogrammed.
I see. Nice detail.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're 2 hours in this and I still want to keep on watching. I mean, this is an epic.
Oh,
this really is an epic of epic proportions.
Yeah, that's a good way to...
It is. The story is epic. I mean, once again.
Yeah. Coppola
took all the elements from essentially a pulp novel and pulled out the best parts to tell this essentially in this epic story.
Nice old billboards that the art director put up. Yes.
I love it that there's a happy, smiling woman on there that says, "Don't worry, Mom." She's covering the phone.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, I remember hearing about this too. I mean, it's like, you know, I didn't see the movie, but like I knew what the big scenes, and this was like
shocking,
the one scene
shocking.
I knew about. This is days before, you know, this is like in the days of television and newspapers,
oh,
and that's
he ducks
it.
Down.
He ducks down, yeah, closes and that, and then.
Wow.
Of course, inspired by the the end of Bonnie and Clyde.
67.
Yeah. Which was, that was definitely stunning. I mean, that was, changed everything. And
I'd say they got him.
I'd say that's definitely sending a signal.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened to the guy at the booth?
He's on the floor. He crawled out the other side.
Flat on the floor.
Yeah. I mean, great use of just still shots.
They had to let it linger because it was so shocking. People had to recover.
Absolutely, yeah. Because no, if you're watching this, you had no idea this is coming. And once again, the use of doors, the slow dolly into the door, and the door to
lots
friend.
Of shadows.
Well, Gordon Willis actually
key
did this,
light on the person.
Did this in Annie Hall, which he shot.
Annie Hall?
Hang on, did he shoot Annie Hall? I think he, I know he shot a lot of Woody Allen stuff, but he'd use doors a lot with Woody Allen.
Gordon Willis shot Manhattan.
Yes, maybe that's what I'm thinking. I don't know if he shot Annie Hall. He may have.
Nice key light on the chair behind the desk, unoccupied.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's Mr. Brando again. It may be noted that actually Marlon Brando won the Academy Award in 1972 and actually had someone go up on stage. I forget her name, but basically
Little
refuse
Feather
it.
Or something.
Yeah, saying having to do with Native American rights.
There's so much urban legend to that.
It caused quite a ruckus. Well, I mean, because I think George C. Scott actually refused his Oscar for
1970.
Patton. 1970. Mm-hmm. That's, I guess, it was de rigueur.
So that's two Coppola projects where the lead actor declined their Oscars.
Interesting.
But, the Little Feather, I think was her name, and urban legend says that she wasn't an actual Indian at all. She was an actress.
Really? I never heard that. Wow. Yeah.
Well, that would be the easiest thing to think of to try to spin it.
Oh.
Hence urban legend, but I guess. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that people were refusing Oscars to
that's the only
make
two,
political
that was the only two times. Well, George just kind of just turned it down because, like, I don't know, like, I don't want it. I just don't believe in getting awards or something like that. You can read about that. But you know, apparently she showed up and it was turned into a political thing.
Oh, it's a major Oscar moment.
Major,
yeah,
major
very
thing.
Interesting.
Very major.
That thing. And The Streaker with David Niven are the two biggest Oscar moments.
Which we never really saw him truly, but surely. Oh, what did David Niven say?
Of all places that a man would show his shortcomings or something. I paraphrase the heck out of it.
It was very, very smooth. I think it was David Niven and Elizabeth Taylor, right?
No, I don't think it was Liz Taylor.
Oh.
No.
Oh, yes. Oh, the 70s.
But David Niven was highly celebrated for that moment.
Yeah,
off
streaking,
the cuff.
Back in 73, streaking was a big thing. It just, I think, did it get started with the song The Streak? Or did
the streaking start after?
Yeah, the streaking started then the song The Streak came out. I think by
Ray. You're really going back here.
Ray something.
Poor these guys.
We're just trying to fill you in here.
Right. I'm just watching the movie.
Play catch up.
Streaking's awesome. Wow. Look at that.
It's a lot of darkness.
Yeah. And there's the guy from the very first scene.
Right.
I Believe in America. And he's calling for, you know, calling in his favor. That's what you call structure. Or part of structure, as John would say.
I wonder how this screenplay falls into the...
Don't know. I'll have to ask him someday. I think this film actually, I mean, stretches... Wait, go ahead.
See, you can't even see Brando's eyes. Just darkness. Yeah. That's what people are freaking out over.
But it fits so well with... I mean, with
when they saw the rushes, they're saying...
But you can still see... I mean, Willis still lit the eyes. You can still see the catch lights in the eyes.
In this closer shot, closer shot. But that and even establishing
when
shot.
When his eyes go up, let's see if we see the catch lights. Oh, he's amazing. Look at that. Oh, Brando was an amazing actor.
Yes, he was. He held nothing back.
Yeah. And now, of course, he's teaching her how to drive, mm-hmm. and that, of course, is very important, because that's right. Essentially, it's a plant and pays off in just a little bit.
Right. I remember this scene.
I like this, what she knows. I like how she messes it up.
Right.
Duncan, have you seen all three Godfathers?
Yes. I don't remember much of anything of the second or third one, though.
Oh, really? Okay. Actually, I think in the film class, we watched both of them. We did watch the second one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. I mean, we watched one, they watched another one. So.
Let's talk as far as your perception on the place that Godfather 3 has and the backlash.
I don't want to talk too much about it, because I think that'll be safer when we actually do Godfather 3, but I don't have I mean, it's not as good or skilled. I mean, I think they brought a lot of the magic together, but it was lacking a little some things. But I think there's some genius stuff in it. Absolutely.
Isn't that the one that Coppola said really he wasn't prepared to make, but he went ahead and did it anyway?
I never heard of that, but that's quite likely. But I mean, for not being prepared, he certainly was able to pull it together. You know.
Financial consideration to do it at that time to get the money to fund other things.
Right.
But I remember that he had said he just wasn't prepared to do it.
Yeah.
So the way he was in his first two.
So now here he says... So you see he's saying, I want to get the car. And of course this guy goes to get the car. And then here's the other guy.
I've forgotten this part. Does something explode?
Mm-hmm. Just keep on watching. But you see, this is where everything comes off. You see, Fabrizio, he said he was going by himself, and this took me like one or two times to figure this out. And I'm like, oh, that's right. And see, he's like, he knows what's going on. It's like this little delay, and then he gets it.
Maybe she's okay.
I don't.
Or
think
yeah.
So.
Maybe she wore her asbestos dress.
When I saw that was horrible. But in the Godfather saga, when they go, because it does, in Godfather Part 2, you never see that character again. But in the Godfather saga, part that they cut out of Godfather Part 2 is you actually see that guy getting. He's in Brooklyn. He's living in Brooklyn. He gets into a car. Car blows up. So in other words, vengeance was saved for many years later. Now this is great. I mean, I know there's a whole speech going on, but I've watched this scene a few times, and this is a great shot going down, but I know you can just tell they just shot them going up, and then they did it the other way, and then they went into ADR and essentially had Brando record the lines
right.
to go along,
sure,
and they cut
sure.
it to it. But it's still a great shot, a great way to introduce all of the all the families, so to speak. Which, now that we're in what I'd say we are in the final act, if you want, of all the action, Or at least this propels it towards that direction. This all plays. Now, what happens with all the families? See, there's the oranges.
Right there. Mm-hmm.
See, right there.
I feel like I know that guy. Who is that actor?
Richard Conti.
Oh, well, no wonder. Wow. He did a lot of noir, too. Richard Conti,
mm-hmm.
back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Or am I getting him mixed up? Richard Egan? Richard?
No, Richard Egan was in A Summer Place. I think Richard Conti, I mean, was definitely an actor from 40s and 50s. Okay. It's interesting that here he is. He's talking about how the drug business is going to just, I mean, you know, he's so old-fashioned,
mm-hmm.
which you see, I mean, you see in Godfather 2, essentially, you see the origins of when he comes to America and how he ran his business and that kind of thing.
I think Richard Conte was in Thieves Highway. Very famous. Yeah, okay, I think that's
was him. He in Ocean's 11, Richard Conte? I'm thinking of someone else.
No, I don't think so. But I think Richard Conte is the actor I remember from Thieves Highway. It's Jules Drazen. I directed that.
Jules Dassin?
Dassin, I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay. Oh.
Interesting. Between him and Sterling Hayden, that's cool.
Yeah, that they're using such... And it's interesting here they're also talking about how, you know, Don Corleone has essentially been controlling most everything. So in a way, if you look at it, the whole arc of the film, basically what this has all been... Well, actually, what you'll start seeing later is that this has been all a subtle plot. Basically, well, of course, they tried to kill him, so basically they could take his power. But now everything's still being done to take his power away. Mm-hmm. In other words, Don Corleone's on the top, and it's like he's even, you know, being attacked by other family elements within, not all the other families, but definitely elements.
So they're all chipping away at him.
Basically, yeah. But it's all very subtle. It's, you know, it's all subterfuge. It's not up front. Well, I mean, clearly how the first act, you know, the second act played out. Have you seen that? Okay, there's a big tapestry of a train in the back. Does that mean anything?
Based on the train sounds we heard before, I don't know.
Ooh.
Oh.
Something's inevitable.
It is an icon of American industry.
Yeah, it is. And, yeah. So you see, now basically he's had to negotiate something away essentially to get the peace.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As if we were lawyers.
Right.
Wow.
I was wondering when he's going to break the sitting.
And now it's to talk mm-hmm. about Michael. I mean, he's forgiven Sonny, but now it's like it's about Michael. Let Michael back in.
Because this whole scene has been sitting around a table with a bunch of people, and that's hard to direct, isn't it?
But they made it work. Yes. Phantom yeah. Menace, it didn't work. Here it worked.
Wow, you had to say those words.
Okay, I'm sorry. The
I'm still waiting for the Ewoks.
Star Wars 1, The Phantom Menace.
Why?
The meeting
Why?
Film.
Why? You know that makes me twitch.
Because the meeting film.
Those things.
This is how you do a meeting. You're looking at me awfully.
Any mention of prequels, I'm sorry.
I can't talk about Jar Jar Binks?
Wow.
You know I love you,
That name was uttered during the Godfather commentary. You heard it
more
here,
than
folks.
Once.
I said it earlier.
Yeah.
You
more
talked about
once.
Ewoks, so I can
well,
talk about Jar Jar.
I'd take Ewoks over Jar Jar Binks any day.
Which is why I have selfish reasons.
I'm listening to him.
To not liking you, sir.
Oh.
We will talk about this in a future day.
So you see, he reaches out. He uses his, basically, his skill as, I mean, as a very skilled, essentially, he's a politician. I mean, he's a politician, businessman. Don Corleone says, let's make the peace so we can do this. I mean, you think about this, those are all the families. Those are the heads of all the families.
Wow. That's a lot of important people there.
Yeah.
So everyone took turns sitting in this interior car set with the lights behind them, right?
Yeah, hang on. This is important. See? This is great. See, here he pegs it. He knew from that meeting that it was Barzini. As he said, it was Barzini all the time, Richard Conti's character.
Right.
So from the very beginning, Barzini had laid all this stuff out.
So fill me in, since I'm a little vague here. What tipped it off to him that it was him the whole time? Was there a moment that I missed? Was there something in that last scene that I should have...
No, I don't know exactly what it was, because I wasn't paying very, very close attention, but it was just basically that Barzini, he noticed with what Tagli was doing that Barzini was essentially leading the meeting and negotiating it. And just, I mean, this is, you know, Vito Corleone. He was able to intuit that it was that Tagli, like he said, he couldn't figure it out, so he had to figure out who was behind it. And like Michael, because that's where Michael gets it from. He gets it from his father. No, and none of his other sons did, neither Sonny nor Fredo. Michael's got his smarts. He could figure out and see people's motives. And he figured out it was Barzini.
Hmm.
Now, this is part of what I'll call the second part of the film. This is the one that was edited differently.
Oh.
In other words, if you start watching it from even from the last scene on, this is essentially kind of like a second film within the first film.
Due to the pacing of editing?
I don't know. I mean, you know, they did, like I said, William Reynolds edited for the most part the first part and the second part by another gentleman, but, and then they evened it all out and made it all work. But there is a difference in story. How the story propels itself has definitely changed now, because now Michael is a godfather, essentially. You know, he's now in charge.
So it shifts over to him.
Yeah. Before we were seeing it was, you know, I've done my little part, but now I'm now in charge.
So does Brando exit pretty much? Or is he still forefront for from here to the rest of the film?
Well, you'll see, he takes a back seat.
Okay.
See, he's even talking how his father's time has passed. I mean, I think actually the implication, and it took me a while to figure this out, a few years have gone by. This is like maybe like 5 years.
Right.
It's quite a bit of time. I mean, I think we're now into early 50s or mid.
Mm-hmm.
I think early 50s, yeah.
It's got to be early 50s, yeah.
And then he enters.
Because it was going on 46 at the beginning of the film.
And then we saw the Thomas Dewey posters. That was 48. And now he comes back into her life. So the interesting thing is, in terms of Michael's character, we never saw him come back from Italy. Right. And we never saw him go up to this point. All we've now done is we've just essentially skipped ahead.
And suddenly he appears and he tells her and the audience that he's been back a year.
Yeah.
Diane Keaton doesn't read newspapers. I mean, is she oblivious to things, or does she know exactly what's going on in this family?
Well, it's not like the newspapers are going to be reporting every single thing they're doing, let alone...
Based on the montages we saw, they were.
But he says basically...
Stuff they handed to them.
But here he says basically that, you know, I need you, but all that stuff that my father does is going away. He's going to take the family legitimate.
Hmm.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that truly his intention? It's like, that's the great part of the great part of the subtlety of his performance is that, does he truly believe that he's going to change the family? Because he doesn't change the family. I mean, things just keep on getting worse.
He could be overly idealistic.
Maybe.
Optimistic.
Now here I think it's implied that actually more years have passed now.
Yeah, he's looking pretty old.
Yeah.
And he's in some very casual clothes, which we have not seen.
And so
and his energy level, and he's very unfocused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so everything that with Barzini, obviously his, and you see, he even tries to talk to Don. And yeah, he's basically, Michael's head of the family.
Probably the first time we've seen a television.
Oh, that's right. When was television introduced? 50, 51, 52?
No, actually the late 40s. It was invented and put out there, but by 52 is becoming pretty prominent in people's homes.
I like how he still keeps on insisting. Listen to Michael.
I guess it's the only way that the power could truly transfer and have the same people there to help. Because, you know, they've been following him for so long.
Ooh. See? And this is where we see Roy Neary. Is that his name?
Roy Neary.
No,
that's
Roy Neary.
Richard Dreyfuss. And
what's his name? No. His last name is Neary. I don't know if this is Roy, but essentially his Luca Brasi. I don't remember his name. His last name is Neary, but he actually shows up in Godfather 2 and Godfather 3. This was interesting. And this goes back to, remember when Sonny was saying, you're not a wartime consigliere? Because remember Sonny was saying, we're at war, and Tom was saying, let's you know, make the peace, let's do business. Mm-hmm. And Sonny said that to him. So now, in that sense, Sonny was right about Tom. Tom was good at some things, but not at essentially being a wartime consigliere. Mm-hmm. Wow. Michael's just like, you're out.
That was...
like, it's so cold. Wow. Like, you're going to Vegas.
Cut.
Go to Vegas. Well, because he can't, you know... Michael's accepting, I'm an executive, this is what I have to do.
Right.
And his father... And his father...
He's not ignorant of anything. I mean, he got sucked in and he was... Didn't know really the depth of what was... He knows exactly.
But what's great also is his father's so... I mean, he's got his father there so that he's got his support and he can still figure out his way through it. And he's got, you know, all the wisdom that his father has. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Fredo... It's totally taken to Las Vegas.
Right?
Completely.
I love the...
To an embarrassing extent.
The white slip-on loafers. It's great.
Look at the bellhops. There's Al Martini again.
Right.
Hmm.
And what makes it, you know, that gives it this epic feel is that in a way there's like three, four different stories that play themselves out through the course of this. It's not just like one story plays itself over 2 hours and we're following the same thread. You know, we have to get down the next 13 blocks.
It evolves
from one thing. And, you know, usually what's hard about, let's say, biopics, which have to go over a number of years, they can't keep themselves going and it feels very episodic. This film manages to, while it's got its episodes, still weave everything into a larger tapestry and keep you involved still, because you can tell underneath the structure is of this whole arc of what's happening to the Corleone family.
And I get the feeling, I mean, you see that the times are changing and they're going with them.
Yeah. Well, the whole idea, you know, the whole thing of moving to Vegas and becoming legitimate. That's my question is, was its plan to actually become legitimate in Vegas? Oh, that's where I was to meet Mo Green.
This whole sequence reminds me of Bugsy a bit. I know it was made much later, but as far as a bookend to Mob and Vegas and everything.
But that's what it was meant to, I mean, to essentially address, the essentially imply this is, you know, it's a fictionalization of Mob involvement in Vegas. But that's the whole thing, is that okay, so he's basically talking to, okay, so he's saying about getting out of olive oil business, but getting his gambling, but is it to legitimately get into it, or basically still operate as a criminal operation.
So you're saying that it's never upfront?
I don't know. I've never really...
You as a viewer would make the decision as to which one it would be?
I've never figured it out, whether Michael is actually on the level of getting out of the family business, so to speak, and going legitimate. Wow.
Duncan, did you ever see Bugsy?
Can't say that I have. That was...
Warren Beatty and
Annette Bening. Right. It was pretty good.
Yeah, it is. It's actually...
Who directed that?
Barry Levinson. And there's Alex Rocco as Mo Green.
Funny.
He's awesome.
Those are risky glasses to have. Another reflections nightmare.
Oh, for real.
Oh, in a way, well, if you look, you can see some of the...
Oh, man.
So now Michael knows, you know, he's basically had him tip his hand. Is that basically Barzini? You know, he's in Barzini's pocket.
Right.
Barzini's backing him. And if Michael's move, as he keeps on thinking, is I got to take Barzini out, then whoever is in Barzini's pocket, I got to get rid of.
I got to give it to Alex Rocco. I mean, he just walks in.
He just dominates.
Takes over this freaking scene. That's great.
Hey, listen, character actors, you know, that's what they do. They deliver.
I mean, it's awesome. He has his one moment, and he puts everything into it.
And also the other thing is that, you know, of course, the one thing he goes after is that you slap my brother around in public. I mean, you don't do that to my family.
Right.
And it's like this little, and once again, that's the subtlety of Pacino's performance. It's just... Wow. Which is what the Don said to Sonny in that meeting with Sollozzo.
Oh, yeah.
So now, I mean, now it's been essentially laid out, you know, Michael's in charge of the business, the father's still the godfather.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. They've got the kid dressed in a tiny little Marine Corps outfit.
Yeah.
And those cars are saying mid-50s.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. This makes me want to go back and read the book.
Now, did you ever read the book before?
I read it after I'd seen the film. So this is interesting. This, essentially, the Don lays everything out about what Michael has to look out, that, you know, Barzini essentially asks for a meeting, and the person who asks for it will be the traitor. I love how it's like he just knows. He knows how it is, so he's just watching for the plays to be made.
Yeah.
You have to forgive me. I was watching the picture while mm-hmm. you were talking a little bit. I was trying to, yes. and you're saying Brando is just now an observer of how things are going to fall into place based on what he's.
No, no. What I'm saying is that he's just told Michael. The Don is now. Don Corleone has just told Michael, this is what you have to look out for. It's Barzini. Barzini will actually, right. you know, if anything should happen, Barzini will ask for a meeting with you. And at the meeting, you'll be killed. And whoever asks you to have that meeting is the traitor amongst you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in other words,
he knows because, I mean, he has this knowledge. I mean, right. clearly he's talented at this thing. This is what he does
Human
well.
Human character.
He understands people.
Intuitive. And
he knows how to make people.
Some things never change, and he knows it's going to come around again. And
but he knows the subtleties of the politics to it. And the interesting thing is, this is the only real scene that the two of these
have
in
yeah.
the film.
Yeah.
In the long extended yeah. scene where they get to act together. I mean, they had little things, but.
Yeah, this is all them.
Yeah. And you see, he's saying, what's bothering you? And you can handle it. See, and look what he does. And this is awesome. He gets up. Because, of course, getting up is important. We have the music. And then he sits in this position so we can get the shot of both of them together like this. And he never... See? He wanted him to be the legitimate one.
So that goes back to the logo holding the strings?
Yeah, I think they're playing on that. Well, I mean, the logo came afterwards, but the whole idea of the puppet master, I mean, the whole idea of wielding power, mm-hmm. but wielding, he wanted him to wield power in a legitimate way. I don't know if this is an epic or a saga.
I'd say saga.
Oh, there you go. Here it is. There you go. That's where the information was put.
And who's it going to be?
Ah, well,
I forget.
I see. I can
predict somebody already.
Well,
but
I mean, I've seen it many times, so I right. know exactly what it is. And, of course...
It's Jar Jar Binks.
I don't remember.
There's Jar Jar Binks. No, see, this is tomatoes. This is an oranges. But he does put an orange, essentially, an orange peel in his mouth. And once again, when I'm, you know, growing up, I was like, oh, I knew about this scene, but seeing the movie for the first time, I'm like, oh, there's that scene. Because back in the 70s, this film had the greatest rep. It was like, you know, it was like the great film.
I remember seeing this, the kid just keeps on going. Brando hits the ground or something. The kid's like, la, 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 just playing.
But I like the hair. Brando's hair. Right, this is Michael's son. Who we next see, of course, in Godfather 2 and Godfather 3. And the kid really, I mean, that's the thing, the kid really got scared. It's like, you know, he's, what, 2 years old? 2 or 3.
I would too if Brando came at me like that.
And so Brando's like, it's okay, go ahead.
I think he'd eat me.
Well, that's the thing, is the child is actually, he's not acting, he's just playing. He's like playing with the guy.
It's all improv.
Yeah. He's like, I'm playing with you. I don't know what you're doing. And, okay, I'll talk about the comedy.
This has Brando improv written all over it.
Basically, what they did is they took two cameras and they shot at once. So basically that camera and this camera.
Yeah.
And they improv this whole sequence.
Yeah.
And the child was just playing with Brando, and Brando did what he was going to do here.
Time to die.
Man, look at that. Boom. See, because, I mean, it's awful. And it plays.
Mm-hmm. This is good when a kid knows something's up.
Well, no, but the reality is, I mean, the reality is, and that's what we interpret as a film. In reality, the kid was just playing. It's like, oh, the man I'm playing with just fell down. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep on playing with him. Now, did you see Godfather 3?
Parts of it.
Did you? You haven't seen, have you seen Godfather 3?
Yeah, but I don't remember it.
May I talk about the very end?
Sure.
For me, one thing I really like about Godfather 3 is the very, very end. I mean, here's Michael who's gone through his life, and he's definitely paying for his sins, and his last shot is just him sitting, you know, on his chair in Sicily, just there, and literally he just crumples over and falls dead in the dust. And I thought that was so perfect. I mean, I love that ending because it's just like it's so useless and a waste of his life, and this is how he ended, by himself.
It's so simple. It's so...
But wasteful is just
you would think that how to go out, you know, some big finish. No,
exactly.
Death comes and...
Well, it's not that death comes. That's what he was left with, just being alone, sitting on a chair in Sicily with no one around him. Okay. Yeah, as opposed to this death here, which is where he, you know, he died playing with his grandson and his family all around. Because that, well, you haven't seen Godfather 2. This becomes a theme, so... It becomes a thing.
I remember, like, the most operatic thing I saw was in Godfather 3, something in the opera house or something.
Oh,
the way it's cut and it's put together, you're like, oh, my gosh, this is, like,
definitely
huge.
So here's Michael. He's watching everybody. it's a funeral for his father, but he's still watching. Mm-hmm. And see, he's watching over there. This is all Michael. Michael's paying attention. Because in a way, this is all about point of view. This is all from Michael's point of view. He's looking, he sees Barzini. Barzini's paying his respects. And he knows it's going to come. Because now that his father's dead, now is the time to, you know, that some kind of change or some kind of challenge to his power is going to happen.
Sure.
Right.
And look, there's the widow. And there you go. It was fish all the time. Well, it wasn't fish all the time. Now it's fish.
I told you. See, fish, the theme.
Well, Oh, there's the funeral director.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they got him in the scene. So it's like now he knows.
Okay, that's just weird. I'm seeing a reflection.
Yeah, there's...
In front of Pacino's face.
Oh, it's on the right side.
See it? And it happened two other times.
That's...
There's a sheet of glass or something. Or there's a...
See that... This is what he tells him. It must be a filter of some sort that's catching his mother just to the right.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's on the Blu-ray.
I'm sure it is.
See, and there we go. Now we see Tessio talking to Barzini.
Right.
And so now Tom Hagen sees, yep, now I know. See, he thought it would have been Clemenza. Oh, that's interesting. He still respects Tessio for doing it.
Right.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. He's not even letting Tom in on what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I remember this scene. This is one of the kind of quintessential scenes of this movie.
Well, it's brilliant. Actually, and Coppola does talk about this in the commentary, too, but in the book, you know, everything that happens now happens sequentially. And I think either the baptism, I don't remember the baptisms in the book, but he used that as a structure to be able to tie everything together in a filmic way, which you have to do if it's a film. Small note, we all know this. The baby in Diane Keaton's arms is Sofia Coppola.
Ah.
I didn't know that. That's
I know Coppola likes to include as much of his family. Yeah,
she'd just been born. So that's Sofia Coppola right there. That intercut with his baptism is all of this. He's cleaning his car. Same place in Brooklyn or whatever, you know, out in the boroughs. I love the organ. The organ is what makes it, really.
Yeah, all the different parts are being put into motion with that organ going through all of it.
Yeah, the organ
just
sets
an ominous tone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all part of the one scene that then can be used for emphasis.
Police badges. Wow.
Yeah. There's Neri. I like this. Clemenza's climbing up all the stairs. It's like, oh, it had to be all the stairs. And, of course, the ceremony's in Latin.
I mean, even more ominous. Yeah.
I mean, it just makes it, like, this is really serious. This
is the whole religious vibe.
As religious
it.
And as holy as it can get. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, it's a baptism. It's
not only
the whole Catholicism.
It's a contrast. It's a juxtaposition of life and death.
But also,
it's new life. It's, you know, spiritual new life.
Baby baptism.
Right. Meanwhile, we're watching, you know, death being doled out, and the agent of that death, who set it all into motion, is there participating in the baptism.
Well, that's the whole, I mean, for
sacrilege.
Me, for me, this is the whole thing, is that Michael here, this is how far he's willing to go, is he's willing to, I don't want to say indulge, basically invoke or conduct himself in the most evil way.
Mm-hmm.
While also accepting, I guess, going into covenant with God, essentially.
Right.
He's saying, I am the Godfather. I'm essentially representing you, and I am going to take care of this child in the same time. Because in a moment, the priest will ask him, Michael Corleone, what does he say about Satan? He says, do you reject Satan? That's right.
Do you reject
Satan in his ways?
Right.
It's coming up right in a second. And everything's been said. I mean, this is classic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, classic. This is just so great in terms of its cross-cutting. Here. Renounce Satan, exactly.
That organ right through there.
Boom. I do. See?
Oof.
Right in the eye. Which is how Bugsy Siegel was killed.
And that was a big deal, to do that stunt with an eyeglass and a squib right next to his eye.
Oh, well, that's a whole thing. Yeah, the commentary talks about it. And these are all the heads of the families and anyone who was with Barzini.
This is major stuff going down.
Yeah.
Well, they killed the guy and the woman he was with.
Huh? See? And that's Neri. And that right there, look at that blood coming out. Wow. Nice stunt. Holy crap. See? Oh, that's the Taglia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not hypocrisy. It's just that he has gone against God. I mean, he's seriously, it's like there's God's way, and he said, I am going the other way, even in your name.
And in a way, it's almost like he did renounce it after he did the bad things, even though they may have been happening simultaneously or after he committed the sin, and then now he's renouncing it. That's an interesting point.
Well,
too.
The way I look at it, no. I think he basically renounced the sin, and the sins were being conducted at the same time or afterwards with his
full
knowledge.
Well, oh, sure, so, but you're I'm saying the act of his sin was to tell them, go kill these guys, after which he was there and he did the renouncing thing.
Which, in my opinion, in my opinion, is just as evil.
Well, sure. I mean, he obviously doesn't intend to keep that. That's really the point. That's the evil point.
Well,
like he's actually renouncing it. Or maybe this is yet another attempt at trying to go straight again. He's like, after this,
and then
I'm done. I'm really doing this cleansing thing, but it really just keeps coming
back.
But
then he's totally blind to his going into evil. I mean,
sure.
Really, he's totally blind to his true, well, not even true nature, just blind to his moral nature.
And at the same time, you know, there are philosophies of, within Catholic Christian circles for justified killing, where you're protecting another life, where you're, the end result is good in some way. Not to get into all the details of that, but having been in the military, he would have been exposed to that.
Right.
Also.
Well, I mean, there's a whole thing also where actually what the Ten Commandments actually say, it's not that shall not kill. I mean, it's translated from the Hebrew,
right.
Thou shall not murder.
Commit murder. Which
but then
is
the question
different.
Is,
what is a murder?
In having those men killed, was that murder or was it
right.
not? I mean, here, with oh, I love this with Tessio. That look. And see, he says it was only business. That's it. That's it. And like, guys, there's like there's six guys around him. And of course, they saved the best for last. God, he comes in, it's like,
yep,
yeah.
This is the one you really feel good about.
You know, wife beater.
Because he does. See, he did. And so he's laying it all out for them. For him. He's got everybody. I think he doesn't know. I mean, he's like, he thinks he's pretty sure about Carlo, but I always felt like he's like, maybe not. He just goads him out. You think all along, it's like, no,
wow.
There's no way.
Right.
And boom, there you go. until he did set him up. And you see, I just always felt that Michael did not know. He's just,
right.
He always thought
he used this to ferret it out.
Yeah, basically it's like, he was just a dupe or whatever. Can back him, whatever. And if he had been no, he would have said, fine, you're still going to Las Vegas, then maybe let him back in. But he let it.
Right.
It's like, and you see,
personally, I would have killed him as a mercy just for that haircut.
You are getting
I don't know. I mean, anyway. I guess it fit with the time.
I'm surprised this guy didn't go on to major.
Just keep on going. Hang on.
Stardom.
Hang on. And of course, Clemens is back there, and they're watching.
Right.
And of course, you cut to a wider shot, so it sets you up for... And I love how the camera's on the car.
Right, and they're driving.
And pulling away, and just that whole angle, so that you're just kicking it up, practically kicks the camera. I mean, that's horrible. But. So now he settled all the scores. He said everyone killed. Okay, I mean, getting back to my argument. Okay, you're right. I mean, the whole thing is revenge. I mean, he did seek revenge for the people who shot his father and killed.
Mm-hmm.
His brother. I mean, that's what he was doing. It's not like it was a naked grab for power. He was exacting revenge for the people who actually attacked them.
Right. Right.
But once again, there's the whole thing of he's accepting the responsibilities as a godfather, and he's in church, and he's saying, "Do you reject Satan and everything?"
Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is it seems really like very reasonable that he would find a way in his mind to justify
right,
that
to,
everything's
to
happening.
Rationalize
so he wouldn't
it.
Even he wouldn't even bat an eye. Like he really meant one and he really meant the other, and in his mind they don't go against each other.
And then of course you have Connie coming to him and basically saying, My personal business supersedes anything that you have to do.
Right.
Your family business. She's throwing it all back in his face.
Mm-hmm.
She's trying to spit on him. Oh, my God. Getting her doctor's going to help. Wow.
And what's her rationalization, Ann Keaton?
I don't know that she has one.
She's kind of being exposed to this, blatantly, nakedly for the first time. Yeah, he is rationalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Is he playing an executive, you know? But. Wow.
This is the first time we see him lose his cool, by the way.
Yep, first time. And this is basically 5 minutes before the film ends.
Mm-hmm.
I guess she can. Well, the whole thing can do it. So he's going to let her ask him. And she asks if it's true. And of course, does he tell the truth? Wow, she's great. No. And of course he lies.
That's all I needed to hear, honey. Right.
Well, I think in a lot of situations, not just people who are involved with organized crime, but many people prefer to turn a blind eye and pretend like everything is okay because they are getting what they feel like they want in life.
Right.
because they are living a life that they want to believe is perfect.
She could be going right into denial, sure.
Yeah.
Well, that trust me, that plays itself out in Godfather Part 2. And I love this. Once again, we're looking over. She's soft, and it's focused on him, mm-hmm. and then you see everyone coming in to do business through the other door.
She's like, mm-hmm. la, la, la.
And there's Clemenza. And now, of course, they kiss his hand, and he's the godfather. Oh, he's Don Corleone. There you mm-hmm. go.
Close the door.
And Neri goes to close the door.
We got business to do.
See? And but she's closing the door, actually, on us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, that's us. So nice. We're...
That's
yeah.
nice.
Yay.
Nice ending. That gave me chills, yay. Actually, to have the door do that.
I haven't clapped for a film in ages.
Door as a wipe.
I think this film is swell.
Don't we
it's
all.
The cat's meow.
I think it should get Best Picture of the Year.
Well, now that might be a little bit of a stretch. No, I'm just kidding.
That Al Pacino guy might have a future.
Just kidding.
Maybe this James Caan guy. Mm-hmm.
He's up and comers.
I don't know.
Yeah, James Caan could do something if he just shaved his shoulders.
Thank you. He had too much hair on the back, on his back and everything.
A little extreme.
This Robert Duvall, I don't know. No career. No, nothing.
A little bit white.
John Marley. Yeah, Richard Castellano, actually, I think, well, he didn't do Godfather 2 for reasons, and he died a few years after that.
Hmm.
As John Cazale died, actually, when he died in the late 70s, early 80s? Oh, yeah. Talia Shire. Mm-hmm. Talia Shire, of course, Francis Ford Coppola's sister. Al Martino, I apologize. Morgana King was the mother. Mm-hmm. That's right, and she was a singer. Gordon Willis, thank you. Oh, he gets a big hand.
Faux show.
Dean Tavolaris, of course, Coppola's designer for many films.
Mm-hmm.
Two editors, Peter Zinner.
He did the second. He did essentially the second part.
All done on a moviola, the old way.
Oh yes, not a Steinbeck.
I don't think so.
I've never worked on a moviola. I don't see. I don't know. I guess I'd have to try it. I think Spielberg still edits on a moviola, right?
Not now.
Not now.
Up until after the last Indiana Jones, I think it was. All moviola.
Walter Murch, post-production.
Then he went over
consultant.
To digital. Yeah. I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah, and Walter Murch actually worked on this, who went on to be big sound designer, and he worked with Luke. Well, Murch worked a lot with Lucas.
Foreign post-production, this Peter Zinner as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, A.D. Flowers did the special effects.
1972, Paramount.
There you go. Color by Technicolor. Yay, Technicolor.
How come I didn't see George Lucas's name in there anywhere about shooting those scenes?
I don't know. He got paid. He didn't get a credit. It's back in the old days before Star Wars.
Well, I know it was before Star Wars, but I mean,
well,
you
should get a credit for doing work.
I didn't explain it. Star Wars actually was the first film to actually list, you know, go through and do like list all the crew. Before that,
just the top people.
Essentially, the ideas with the credits was mostly the keys.
Hmm.
Yeah, not and Star Wars actually started the tradition of having everyone who worked on the film get a credit. And
you
that's
think maybe it was
because
he was sore about not getting a credit on this?
Absolutely, because where's my credit for right? Godfather shooting the insert?
When was American Graffiti?
73.
The next year, huh?
So he broke out with that.
Yeah, and actually,
soon
and actually Coppola produced that, I think. Yeah,
it's also incestuous.
I think it was
everyone has everything to do with each other. That crazy business of film movies.
What?
Well, that would happen. That would happen. So what do you think? Does this improve your appreciation of The Godfather? Probably one of the greatest films
in
the American
time,
canon.
But I didn't have sympathy for anyone.
Come on, didn't you feel for anybody? Not even for Michael?
Mm-mm.
Mm. But did you?
No, no. Definitely. I mean, he had his points, but... Everyone was everyone's intent of the heart. Everyone's intention was perfectly laid out, and I don't feel anyone was victimized or taken advantage of to come to a bad end. They shouldn't. I feel everyone saw the writing on the wall and then went down the path where it led them.
Is it a
except for Apollonia?
Yeah.
Even that. I mean, her father should have looked out for her. I wouldn't say here, marry this guy.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it. Just knew it. Yeah, so basically everyone paid the piper.
Yeah, it's true. Apollonia, as far as her personally, but that could have been prevented. had her father's, you know. I mean, everything done something that was right and just to guard his daughter, you know. That's what I would, well, I'm very fervent about that.
I know.
I just don't see why people glorify it and say, all these poor people, they're getting, I really admire this person. I have sympathy for this person. I admire this. No, these are people who sow, who plant seeds and reap what they sow.
Right.
It's a very biblical thing to say. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword.
You know?
But that's what I mean. But in a way, I mean, they kind of acknowledge that. I mean, they're in this business. So,
yeah. So I mean, as far as the question was sympathy. I don't have sympathy.
No, I'm not saying sympathy, but an appreciation for the film. I mean, did you like it more?
Appreciation for the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for its time and the way it created a world and the inhabitants of that world for us to follow along with and everything. Very much so. It was beautifully put together, and I'm thrilled by the people, that it's all about the people.
Right.
You know, I like that it's the characters it's all about. I like that.
I think it definitely holds up. I mean, it does. It does not. It doesn't feel dated in the least. I can't think of a single thing off the top of my head.
Being a period piece helps that.
Well, yeah. Oh, definitely. Right. Definitely help that.
Yeah, there are some pieces that really like try to point it out to you where it and when it takes place. Mm-hmm. This doesn't. It's just like it's a story that happened to take place
a long time ago. Yeah. Context. Watching it for many times, I mean, it's like, well, I know it took place a long time ago, but I never really tried. You know, it's almost like I never really tried to figure out when it took place because it never really hammered it over my head.
Mm-hmm.
This is when it takes place. So they do mention a year once.
Right.
And I never really thought about it. It's like, and 50s, 40s.
I think that's a good example of how excellent writing, excellent acting,
excellent directing.
All, you know, it doesn't matter what context it takes place in. Mm-hmm. It's still going to be very watchable and very, you know, enjoyable. You can always take something away from it. Case in point, Battlestar Galactica also. Jumping all the way to the other end, away from, you know, the period piece idea. Same thing. That series, the new series to be exact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could follow along with that. You could take those characters and, you know, that writing and that directing and put them in any context, and it would have been equally brilliant.
Yeah.
You know what my favorite moment was, and it's going to sound inane after everything we just witnessed for 3 hours. Was the moment with Diane Keaton and Al Pacino on the street after Bells of St. Mary's, and she says, "Should I be a nun?" But that direction with the newsstand,
mm-hmm.
I think that it was because it surprised me, and I was not two steps ahead of something, and to see her face go from the happiness and the coy flirty to, you know, just crestfallen with that wipe of the newsstand out of focus coming mm-hmm. forward, and then you find out later. It was just, it caught me by surprise, and it's those moments that are very thrilling.
Well,
no matter how small, but it was, I was not expecting, and it was life. It was life happening in front of me that I couldn't outguess, and I liked that when those moments happened.
And I think
it's very refreshing.
And I think part of the craft that definitely worked in there, the way you mentioned it, is the way Coppola worked with Gordon Willis, so that all the compositions were, there was definitely a leading in visually. You never saw anything like full on, oh, here it is. Something always led into something, whether someone came out from the dark into mm-hmm. the light, but they always used something in the foreground and shooting just subtly over another object, and there were definitely different planes of vision. I mean, of course, this is Gordon mm-hmm. Willis's genius mm-hmm. of how he framed it. It was the two of them obviously working together to some extent to tell the story visually, so you could turn the sound off and still get a feel, mm-hmm. and that's what it told us. It told you knew something was going on, even though you didn't have to see the newsstand, and you saw her reaction, and you saw that. And that goes back to the editing too, because I'm sure it was shot, you know, several different angles, but by cutting it that way, it led mm-hmm. you and led us,
a wonderful choice,
into the moment and allowed us to discover it, but in just the right way. I mean, it still works.
Mm-hmm.
How we watch movies today, this still works with how we read a film and how we mm-hmm. interpret it, which just once again makes it.
I admire that.
Brilliant.
I also admire this menu that you're sitting here at the toll booth, and it's the wind's always blowing with the cadaver in the car.
You know, I think this changes. It depends. I don't know.
They just took the one shot and they loop it.
No, I know.
Because you'll see the puppet.
No, I know.
Logo
But I think the background. I think what we're seeing, which is the car with the bullets in, I think that changes. I think it does. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking of another DVD. It
hasn't changed since we...
Maybe not this one. Maybe if you go to Scene Selection,
it's just been murdered,
up,
and we're sitting there, and no one's coming to his aid. I sort of like that. It's ominous.
Just so we can change it. Anyway, Duncan, so you still like this after seeing it several times?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's kind of an icon of American film. You know? Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of things that were unique when it came out, and it's got a lot of... Well, like I've talked about in other places... Your basic storytelling, sort of, you know, mythological elements are often recurring, and they just make good stories. And you know, you're talking about family, you're talking about obligation, you're talking about, you know, the guy who isn't involved, who has to, you know, rise up and get involved, and you know, in the crisis, you know, it's it's just good storytelling.
No, I think it's very interesting storytelling. See the menu?
Oh, see.
Once you go back to
when
it, you go into it and you go in and out of the menu, then it changes. So now we're looking at the bull rushes with the car.
See him get
shot? Statue of Liberty.
That'd be kind of fun.
No, actually, it'd be interesting to try and find where they loop this. I just think, I mean, it's great how this shook up how you tell a story. I think Patton, in a way, is the same thing. If I remember, I haven't seen Patton in a while. Patton's a rather long film, too, but also that's a bit of a biopic. And there isn't...
Complete biopic.
It's there's not that, you know, what I'll call the 2-hour arc, or you know, like a Die Hard arc, where it starts one, where it went around the loop,
mm-hmm.
Where you know where you're going within the first 10 minutes, where the film is going to go, you know, and get an idea. I mean, it may go left, it may go right, but where it's going to come to a conclusion. It's that same kind of feel. And I mean, clearly, Copeland Towns was able to tackle this and make this work. And it's just a great example of a different kind of filmmaking. I don't think necessarily everyone can do it, and every film should be like that, but for the appropriate stories, this is a great example of that kind of thing.
What's impressive also is that context. 1972, this blew the doors off as far as inventiveness and shocking in its visualizations, which have become so pat in today's, you know, between The Sopranos and every other mob thing, but it hasn't aged to its detriment, that everyone else took it and took the ball and ran with it on the way of staging and, you know, da-da-da-da. This holds up still today.
Right. Well, also...
It doesn't look tired because everyone else has mimicked it to death, so when you see the original, you're going, oh, this is cliche.
Right.
See? So...
But even in the portrayal, actually, you're right. I mean, even in the portrayal of the mob, or, you know, I mean, essentially, the town, what we call the mob, this definitely changed how all that was portrayed. I mean, it brought it down. The story was about the American dream, about family, and how all this plays out in its context, and made it essentially, and more importantly, became Michael's story. I mean, it started off as a Godfather, but became Michael's story, which then extends definitely. Godfather Part 2 is Michael's story. Mm. And then, of course, Godfather 3 is the extension of Michael's story. How successful or not can be argued, but, mm-hmm. I mean, definitely elements that can work and, you know. So
I will say that I'm very hungry. That movie makes you hungry. Everyone's eating in between killings.
I want some pasta.
I want some meatballs.
There's a very weird sound outside. Anyway, I think that's a cue for us to...
wrap her up.
Bid adieu to our Film Grok audience. So this has been The Godfather, and this has been...
Tim McMillan.
And
Duncan K. Fraser.
And Serge Dalpierre. See you next time.
Indeed.